Chapter 17. Best while you have it, use your breath. There is no drinking after death. John Fletcher, the Bloody Brother. It was not the first time that Strike had visited New Scotland Yard at the insistence of the Met. His previous interview had also concerned a corpse, and it occurred to the detective, as he sat waiting in an interrogation room many hours later, the pain in his knee less acute after several hours of enforced action, that he had had sex the previous evening then, too. Alone in a room, hardly bigger than the average office's stationery cupboard, his thoughts stuck like flies to the rotting obscenity he had found in the artist's studio. The horror of it had not left him. In his professional capacity, he had viewed bodies that had been dragged into positions intended to suggest suicide or accident, had examined corpses bearing horrific traces of attempts to disguise the cruelty to which they had been subjected before death. He had seen men, women, and children maimed and dismembered. But what he had seen at 179 Talgarth Road was something entirely new. The malignity of what had been done there had been almost orgiastic, a carefully calibrated display of sadistic showmanship. Worse to contemplate was the order in which acid had been poured, the body disemboweled. Had it been torture? Had Quine been alive or dead while his killer laid out place settings around him? The huge vaulted room where Quine's body lay would now, no doubt, be swarming with men in full-body protective suits, gathering forensic evidence. Strike wished he were there with them. Inactivity after such a discovery was hateful to him. He burned with professional frustration. Shut out from the moment the police had arrived, he had been relegated to a mere blunderer who had stumbled onto the scene. And scene, he thought suddenly, was the right word in more ways than one. The body tied up and arranged in the light from that giant church-like window. A sacrifice to some demonic power. 7 plates, 7 sets of cutlery. The frosted glass window of the interrogation room blocked out everything beyond it but the colour of the sky, now black. He had been in this tiny room for a long time, and still the police had not finished taking his statement. It was difficult to gauge how much of their desire to prolong the interview was genuine suspicion, how much animosity. It was right, of course, that the person who discovered a murder victim should be subjected to thorough questioning, because they often knew more than they were willing to tell, and not infrequently, knew everything. However, in solving the Lula Landry case, Strike might be said to have humiliated the Met, who had so confidently pronounced her death suicide. Strike did not think he was being paranoid in thinking that the attitude of the crop-haired female detective inspector, who had just left the room, contained a determination to make him sweat. Nor did he think that it had been strictly necessary for quite so many of her colleagues to look in on him, some of them lingering only to stare at him, others delivering snide remarks. If they thought they were inconveniencing him, they were wrong. He had nowhere else to be, and they had fed him quite a decent meal. If they had only let him smoke, he would have been quite comfortable. The woman who had been questioning him for an hour had told him he might go outside, accompanied, into the rain for a cigarette, but inertia and curiosity had kept him in his seat. His birthday whiskey sat beside him in its carrier bag. He thought that if they kept him here much longer, he might break it open. They had left him a plastic beaker of water. The door behind him whispered over the dense grey carpet.
"Mystic Bob," said a voice.
Richard Anstis, of the Metropolitan Police and the Territorial Army, entered the room grinning, his hair wet with rain, carrying a bundle of papers under his arm. One side of his face was heavily scarred, the skin beneath his right eye pulled taut. They had saved his sight at the field hospital in Kabul, while Strike had lain unconscious, doctors working to preserve the knee of his severed leg. Anstice, said Strike, taking the policeman's proffered hand. What the... Pull rank, mate. I'm going to handle this one, said Anstice, dropping into the seat lately vacated by the surly female detective. You're not popular around here, you know. Lucky for you, you've got Uncle Dickie on your side, vouching for you. He always said that Strike had saved his life, and perhaps it was true. They had been under fire on a yellow dirt road in Afghanistan. Strike himself was not sure what had made him sense the imminent explosion. The youth running from the roadside ahead, with what looked like his younger brother, could simply have been fleeing the gunfire. All he knew was that he had yelled at the driver of the Viking to brake, an injunction not followed, perhaps not heard, that he had reached forward, grabbed Anstice by the back of the shirt, and hauled him one-handed into the back of the vehicle. Had Anstice remained where he was, he would probably have suffered the fate of young Gary Topley, who had been sitting directly in front of Strike, and of whom they could only find the head and torso to bury.
Need to run through this story one more time, mate, said Anstice, spreading out in front of him the statement that he must have taken from the female officer.
All right if I drink? Asked Strike wearily.
Under Anstice's amused gaze, Strike retrieved the Aran single malt from the carrier bag and added two fingers to the lukewarm water in his plastic cup.
Right. You were hired by his wife to find the dead man. We're assuming the body's this writer's, this... Owen Quine, yeah, supplied Strike, as Anstice squinted over his colleague's handwriting. His wife hired me 6 days ago. And at that point he'd been missing... 10 days.
But she hadn't been to the police?
No, he did this regularly. Dropped out of sight without telling anyone where he was, then coming home again. He liked taking off for hotels without his wife.
Why did she bring you in this time?
Things are difficult at home. There is a disabled daughter and money's short. He'd been away a bit longer than usual. She thought he'd gone off to a writer's retreat. She didn't know the name of the place, but I checked and he wasn't there.
Still don't see why she called you rather than us.
She says she called your lot in once before when he went walkabout and he was angry about it. Apparently he'd been with a girlfriend.
I'll check that, said Anstice, making a note.
What made you go to that house?
I found out last night the Quines co-owned it.
A slight pause. His wife hadn't mentioned it.
No, said Strike. Her story is he hated the place and never went near it. She gave the impression she'd half forgotten they even owned it.
Was that likely? Murmured Anstice, scratching his chin. If their skin
was complicated, said Strike. The other owner's Michael Fancourt.
I've heard of him.
And she says he won't let them sell. There was bad blood between Fancourt and Quine.
Strike drank his whiskey. It warmed throat and stomach. Quine's stomach, his entire digestive tract, had been cut out. Where the hell was it?
Anyway, I went along at lunchtime and there he was. Or most of him was.
The whiskey had made him crave a cigarette worse than ever. The body's a real fucking mess from what I've heard, said Anstice.
Wanna see?
Strike pulled his mobile phone from his pocket, brought up the photograph of the corpse, and handed it across the desk.
Holy shit, said Anstice.
After a minute of silent contemplation of the rotting corpse, he asked, disgusted,
What are those around him? Plates?
Yep, said Strike.
That mean anything to you?
Nothing, said Strike.
Any idea when he was last seen alive?
The last time his wife saw him was the night of the 5th. He'd just had dinner with his agent who told him he couldn't publish his latest book because he's libeled Christ knows how many people, including a couple of very litigious men.
Anstice looked down at the notes left by D.I. Rawlins.
You didn't tell Bridget that?
She didn't ask. We didn't strike up much of a rapport.
How long has this book been in the shops?
It isn't in the shops, said Strike,
adding more whiskey to his beaker. It hasn't been published yet. I told you he rode with his agent because she told him he couldn't publish it. Have you read it?
Most of it.
Did his wife give you a copy?
No, she says she's never read it.
She forgot she owned a second house and she doesn't read her own husband's books, said Anstis, without emphasis.
Her story is that she reads them once they got proper covers on, said Strike. For what it's worth, I believe her.
Uh-huh, said Anstis, who was now scribbling additions to Strike's statement. How did you get a copy of the manuscript?
I'd prefer not to say.
Could be a problem, said Anstis, glancing up.
Not for me, said Strike.
We might need to come back to that one, Bob. Strike shrugged, then asked,
Has his wife been told?
Should have been by now, yeah.
Strike had not called Leonora. The news that her husband was dead must be broken in person by somebody with the necessary training. He had done the job himself many times, but he was out of practice. In any case, his allegiance this afternoon had been to the desecrated remains of Owen Quine, to stand watch over them until he had delivered them safely into the hands of the police. He had not forgotten what Leonora would be going through while he was interrogated at Scotland Yard. He had imagined her opening the door to the police officer, or two of them perhaps, the first thrill of alarm at the sight of the uniform, the hammer blow dealt to the heart by the calm, understanding, sympathetic invitation to retire indoors. The horror of the pronouncement. Although they would not tell her, at least at first, about the thick purple ropes binding her husband, or the dark, empty cavern that a murderer had made of his chest and belly. They would not say that his face had been burned away by acid, or that somebody had laid out plates around him as though he were a giant roast. Strike remembered the platter of lamb that Lucy had handed around nearly 24 hours previously. He was not a squeamish man, but the smooth malt seemed to catch in his throat, and he set down his beaker.
How many people know what's in this book, do you reckon?
Asked Anstis slowly.
No idea, said Strike. Could be a lot by now. Quine's agent, Elizabeth Tassel, spelled like it sounds, he added helpfully, as Anstis scribbled. Sent it to Christian Fisher at Crossfire Publishing, and he's a man who likes to gossip. Lawyers got involved to try and stop the talk.
More and more interesting, muttered Anstis, writing fast. You want anything else to eat, Bob?
I want a smoke.
Won't be long, promised Anstis. Who's he libeled?
The question is, said Strike, flexing his sore leg, whether it's libel or whether he's exposed the truth about people. But the characters I recognize were, give us a pen and paper, he said, because it was quicker to write than to dictate.
He said the names aloud as he jotted them down.
Michael Fancourt, the writer. Daniel Chard, who's head of Quine's publisher. Catherine Kent, Quine's girlfriend.
There's a girlfriend?
Yeah, they've been together over a year, apparently. I went to see her, Stafford Cripp's house, part of Clement Attlee Court, and she claimed he wasn't at her flat and she hadn't seen him. Liz Tassel, his agent. Jerry Waldegrave, his editor, and, a fractional hesitation, his wife. He's put his wife in there as well, has he?
Yeah, said Strike, pushing the list over the desk to Anstis. But there are a load of other characters I wouldn't recognize. You've got a wide field if you're looking for someone he put in the book.
Have you still got the manuscript?
No.
Strike, expecting the question, lied easily. Let Anstis get a copy of his own, without Nina's fingerprints on it.
Anything else you can think of that might be helpful? Anstis asked, sitting up straight.
Yeah, said Strike. I don't think his wife did it.
Anstis shot Strike a quizzical look, not unmixed with warmth. Strike was godfather to the son who had been born to Anstis, just 2 days before both of them had been blown out of the Viking. Strike had met Timothy Cormoran Anstis a handful of times and had not been impressed in his favour.
Okay, Bob, sign this for us and I can give you a lift home.
Strike read through the statement carefully, took pleasure in correcting D.I. Rawlins's spelling in a few places, and signed. His mobile rang as he and Anstis walked down the long corridor towards the lifts, Strike's knee protesting painfully.
Cormoran Strike.
It's me, Leonora, she said,
sounding almost exactly as she usually did, except that her voice was perhaps a little less flat. Strike gestured to Anstis that he was not ready to enter the lift and drew aside from the policeman to a dark window beneath which traffic was winding in the endless rain.
Have the police been to see you?
He asked her.
Yeah, I'm with them now.
I'm very sorry, Leonora, he said.
You all right?
She asked gruffly.
Me? Said Strike, surprised. I'm fine.
They ain't giving you our time. They said you were being interviewed. I said to him. He only found Owen because I asked him. What's he been arrested for?
They hadn't arrested me, said Strike. Just needed a statement.
But they've kept you all this time.
How do you know how long?
I'm here, she said. I'm downstairs in the lobby. I want to see you. I made him bring me.
Astonished, with the whiskey sitting on his empty stomach, he said the first thing that occurred to him.
Who's looking after Orlando?
Edna, said Leonora, taking Strike's concern for her daughter as a matter of course. When are they going to let you go?
I'm on my way out now, he said.
Who's that? Asked Anstis, when Strike had rung off. Charlotte worrying about you?
Christ, no, said Strike as they stepped together into the lift.
He had completely forgotten that he had never told Anstis about the breakup. As a friend from the Met, Anstis was sealed off in a compartment on his own where gossip could not travel.
That's over. Ended months ago.
Really? Tough break, said Anstis, looking genuinely sorry as the lift began to move downwards.
But Strike thought that some of Anstis's disappointment was for himself. He had been one of the friends most taken with Charlotte, with her extraordinary beauty and her dirty laugh. Bring Charlotte over, had been Anstis's frequent refrain when the two men had found themselves free of hospitals in the army, back in the city that was their home. Strike felt an instinctive desire to shield Leonora from Anstis, but it was impossible. When the lift doors slid open, there she was, thin and mousy, with her limp hair in combs, her old coat wrapped around her, and an air of still wearing bedroom slippers, even though her feet were clad in scuffed black shoes. She was flanked by the two uniformed officers, one female, who had evidently broken the news of Quine's death and then brought her here. Strike deduced from the guarded glances they gave Anstis that Leonora had given them reason to wonder, that her reaction to the news that her husband was dead had struck them as unusual. Dry-faced and matter-of-fact, Leonora seemed relieved to see Strike.
There you are, she said. Why'd they keep you so long?
Anstis looked at her curiously, but Strike did not introduce them.
Shall we go over here? He asked her, indicating a bench along the wall.
As he limped off beside her, he felt the three police officers draw together behind them.
How are you?
He asked her, partly in the hope that she might exhibit some sign of distress to assuage the curiosity of those watching.
Dunno, she said, dropping onto the plastic seat. I can't believe it. I never thought he'd go there, the silly sod. I suppose some burglar got in and done it. He should have gone to a hotel like always, shouldn't he?
They had not told her much then. He thought that she was more shocked than she appeared, more than she knew herself. The act of coming to him seemed the disorientated action of somebody who did not know what else to do except to turn to the person
who was supposed to be helping her.
"Would you like me to take you home?" Strike asked her.
"I expect they'll give me a lift back," she said, with the same sense of untroubled entitlement she had brought to the statement that Elizabeth Tassel would pay Strike's bill.
"I wanted to see you to check you was all right, and I hadn't got you into trouble. And I wanted to ask you if you'll keep working for me."
"Keep working for you?" Strike repeated.
For a split second, he wondered whether it was possible that she had not quite grasped what had happened, that she thought Quine was still out there somewhere to be found. Did her faint eccentricity of manner mask something more serious? Some fundamental cognitive problem.
"They think I know something about it," said Leonora.
"I can tell."
Strike hesitated on the verge of saying, "I'm sure that's not true," but it would have been a lie. He was only too aware that Leonora, wife of a feckless, unfaithful husband, who had chosen not to contact the police and to allow 10 days to elapse before making a show of looking for him, who had a key to the empty house where his body had been found, and who would undoubtedly be able to take him by surprise, would be the first and most important suspect. Nevertheless, he asked,
"Why do you think that?"
"I can tell," she repeated. "Why they were talking to me, and they said they want to look in our house in his study."
It was routine, but he could see how she would feel this to be intrusive and ominous.
"Does Orlando know what's happened?" he asked.
"I told her, but I don't think she realizes," said Leonora. And for the first time he saw tears in her eyes. "She says, like Mr. Poop."
"He was our cat that was run over. But I don't know if she understands. Not really.
You can't always tell with Orlando. I haven't told her someone killed him. Can't get my head around it."
There was a short pause in which Strike hoped, irrelevantly, that he was not giving off whiskey fumes.
"Will you keep working for me?" she asked him directly. "You're better than them. That's why I wanted you in the first place. Will you?"
"Yes," he said.
"Because I can tell they think I had something to do with it," she repeated, standing up. "Why they was talking to me."
She drew her coat more tightly around her.
"I'd better get back to Orlando. I'm glad you're all right."
She shuffled off to her escort again. The female police officer looked taken aback to be treated like a taxi driver, but after a glance at Anstis, acceded to Leonora's request for a lift home.
"The hell was that about?"
Anstis asked him, after the two women had passed out of earshot.
"She was worried you'd arrested me."
"Bit eccentric, isn't she?"
"Yeah, a bit."
"You didn't tell her anything, did you?"
asked Anstis.
"No," said Strike, who resented the question. He knew better than to pass information about a crime scene to a suspect.
"You want to be careful, Bob," said Anstis awkwardly, as they passed through the revolving doors into the rainy night. "Not to get under anyone's feet.
It's murder now, and you haven't got many friends around these parts, mate."
"Popularity's overrated. Listen, I'll get a cab."
"No," he said firmly, over Anstis's protestations.
"I need to smoke before I go anywhere.
Thanks, Rich.
For everything."
They shook hands. Strike turned up his collar against the rain, and with a wave of farewell, limped off along the dark pavement. He was almost as glad to have shaken off Anstis as to take the first sweet pull on his cigarette.
Chapter 18. For this I find, where jealousy is fed, horns in the mind are worse than on the head. Ben Jonson, Every Man in His Humour.
Strike had completely forgotten that Robin had left the office in what he categorized as a sulk on Friday afternoon. He only knew that she was the one person he wanted to talk to about what had happened, and while he usually avoided telephoning her at weekends,
the circumstances felt exceptional enough to justify a text. He sent it from the taxi he found after 15 minutes tramping wet, cold streets in the dark. Robin was curled up at home in an armchair with Investigative Interviewing, Psychology and Practice, a book she had bought online. Matthew was on the sofa, speaking on the landline to his mother in Yorkshire, who was feeling unwell again. He rolled his eyes whenever Robin reminded herself to look up and smile sympathetically at his exasperation. When her mobile vibrated, Robin glanced at it irritably. She was trying to concentrate on Investigative Interviewing. Found Quine murdered. See. She let out a mingled gasp and shriek that made Matthew start. The book slipped out of her lap and fell, disregarded, to the floor. Seizing the mobile, she ran with it to the bedroom. Matthew talked to his mother for 20 minutes more, then went and listened at the closed bedroom door. He could hear Robin asking questions and being given what seemed to be long, involved answers. Something about the timbre of her voice convinced him that it was Strike on the line. His square jaw tightened. When Robin finally emerged from the bedroom, shocked and awestruck, she told her fiancé that Strike had found the missing man he had been hunting and that he had been murdered. Matthew's natural curiosity tugged him one way, but his dislike of Strike and the fact that he had dared contact Robin on a Sunday evening pulled him another. "Well, I'm glad something happened to interest you tonight," he said. "I know you're bored shitless by Mum's health."
"You bloody hypocrite,"
gasped Robin, winded by the injustice. The row escalated with alarming speed. Strike's invitation to the wedding, Matthew's sneering attitude to Robin's job, what their life together was going to be, what each owed the other. Robin was horrified by how quickly the very fundamentals of their relationship were dragged out for examination and recrimination, but she did not back down. A familiar frustration and anger towards the men in her life had her in its grip. To Matthew, for failing to see why her job mattered to her so much. To Strike, for failing to recognize her potential. But he had called her when he had found the body. She had managed to slip in a question, "Who else have you told?" And he had answered, without any sign that he knew what it would mean to her, "No one, only you." Meanwhile, Matthew was feeling extremely hard done by. He had noticed lately something that he knew he ought not to complain about, and which grated all the more for his feeling that he must lump it. Before she worked for Strike, Robin had always been first to back down in a row, first to apologize, but her conciliatory nature seemed to have been warped by the stupid bloody job. They only had one bedroom. Robin pulled spare blankets from on top of the wardrobe, grabbed clean clothes from inside it, and announced her intention to sleep on the sofa. Sure that she would cave before long, the sofa was hard and uncomfortable. Matthew did not try to dissuade her. But he had been wrong in expecting her to soften. When he woke the following morning, it was to find an empty sofa and Robin gone. His anger increased exponentially. She had doubtless headed for work an hour earlier than usual, and his imagination, Matthew was not usually imaginative, showed him that big, ugly bastard opening the door of his flat, not the office below. Chapter 19. I to you will open the book of a black sin deep printed in me. My disease lies in my soul. Thomas Dekker, the noble Spanish soldier. Strike had set his alarm for an early hour, with the intention of securing some peaceful, uninterrupted time without clients or telephone. He rose at once, showered and breakfasted, took great care over the fastening of the prosthesis onto a definitely swollen knee, and 45 minutes after waking, limped into his office with the unread portion of Bombix Mori under his arm. A suspicion that he had not confided to Anstis was driving him to finish the book as a matter of urgency. After making himself a mug of strong tea, he sat down at Robin's desk, where the light was best, and began to read. Having escaped the cutter and entered the city that had been his destination, Bombyx decided to rid himself of the companions of his long journey, Succuba and the Tick. This he did by taking them to a brothel, where both appeared satisfied to work. Bombyx departed alone in search of Vainglorious, a famous writer, and the man whom he hoped would be his mentor. Halfway along a dark alleyway, Bombyx was accosted by a woman with long red hair and a demonic expression, who was taking a handful of dead rats home for supper. When she learned Bombyx's identity, Harpy invited him to her house, which turned out to be a cave littered with animal skulls. Strike skim-read the sex, which took up 4 pages, and involved Bombyx being strung up from the ceiling and whipped. Then, like the Tick, Harpy attempted to breastfeed from Bombyx, but in spite of being tied up, he managed to beat her off. While his nipples leaked a dazzling supernatural light, Harpy wept and revealed her own breasts, from which leaked something dark brown and glutinous. Strike scowled over this image. Not only was Quine's style starting to seem parodic, giving Strike a sense of sick and surfeit, the scene read like an explosion of malice, an eruption of pent-up sadism. Had Quine devoted months, perhaps years, of his life to the intention of causing as much pain and distress as possible? Was he sane? Could a man in such masterly control of his style, little though Strike liked it, be classified as mad? He took a drink of tea, reassuringly hot and clean, and read on. Bombyx was on the point of leaving Harpy's house in disgust when another character burst in through her door. Epicene, whom the sobbing Harpy introduced as her adopted daughter. A young girl whose open robes revealed a penis, Epicene insisted that she and Bombyx were twin souls, understanding as they did both the male and the female. She invited him to sample her hermaphrodite's body, but first to hear her sing. Apparently, under the impression that she had a beautiful voice, she emitted barks like a seal until Bombyx ran from her with his ears covered. Now Bombyx saw for the first time, high on a hill in the middle of the city, a castle of light. He climbed the steep streets towards it until hailed from a dark doorway by a male dwarf, who introduced himself as the writer, Vainglorious. He had Fancourt's eyebrows, Fancourt's surly expression, and a sneering manner, and offered Bombyx a bed for the night, having heard of your great talent. To Bombyx's horror, a young woman was chained up inside the house, writing at a roll-top desk. Burning brands lay white-hot in the fire, to which were attached phrases in twisted metal such as pertinacious gudgeon and christotomatic intercourse. Evidently expecting Bombyx to be amused, Vainglorious explained that he had set his young wife Effigy to write her own book so that she would not bother him while he created his next masterpiece. Unfortunately, Vainglorious explained, Effigy had no talent, for which she must be punished. He removed one of the brands from the fire, at which Bombyx fled the house, pursued by Effigy's shrieks of pain. Bombyx sped on towards the Castle of Light, where he imagined he would find his refuge. Over the door was the name Phallus Impudicus, but nobody answered Bombyx's knock. He therefore skirted the castle, peering in through windows, until he saw a naked bald man standing over the corpse of a golden boy, whose body was covered in stab wounds, each of which emitted the same dazzling light that issued from Bombyx's own nipples. Phallus's erect penis appeared to be rotting. "Hi." Strike started and looked up. Robin was standing there in her trench coat, her face pink, long red gold hair loose, tousled and gilded in the early sunlight streaming through the window. Just then, Strike found her beautiful. "Why are you so early?" he heard himself ask. "Wanted to know what's going on?" She stripped off her coat, and Strike looked away, mentally castigating himself.
Naturally, she looked good, appearing unexpectedly when his mind had been full of the image of a naked bald man displaying a diseased penis. "Do you want another tea?"
"That'd be great, thanks," he said, without lifting his eyes from the manuscript. "Give me 5, I want to finish this."
And with a feeling that he was diving again into contaminated water, he re-immersed himself in the grotesque world of Bombix Mori. As Bombix stared through the window of the castle, transfixed by the horrible sight of Phallus Impudicus and the corpse, he found himself roughly seized by a crowd of hooded minions, dragged inside the castle, and stripped naked in front of Phallus Impudicus. By this time, Bombix's belly was enormous, and he appeared ready to give birth. Phallus Impudicus gave ominous directions to his minions, which left the naive Bombix convinced that he was to be the guest of honour at a feast. 6 of the characters that Strike had recognised, Succuba, the Tick, the Cutter, Harpy, Vainglorious, and Impudicus, were now joined by Epicene. The 7 guests sat down at a large table, on which stood a large jug, the contents of which were smoking, and a man-sized empty platter. When Bombix arrived in the hall, he found that there was no seat for him. The other guests rose, moved towards him with ropes, and overpowered him. He was trussed up, placed on the platter, and slit open. The mass that had been growing inside him was revealed to be a ball of supernatural light, which was ripped out and locked in a casket by Phallus Impudicus. The contents of the smoking jug were revealed to be vitriol, which the 7 attackers poured gleefully over the still-living, shrieking Bombix. When at last he fell silent, they began to eat him. The book ended with the guests filing out of the castle, discussing their memories of Bombix without guilt, leaving behind them an empty hall, the still-smoking remains of the corpse on the table, and the locked casket of light hanging, lamp-like, above him.
"Shit," said Strike, quietly.
He looked up. Robin had placed a fresh tea beside him without his noticing. She was perched on the sofa, waiting quietly for him to finish.
"It's all in here," said Strike. "What happened to Quine? It's here."
"What do you mean?"
"The hero of Quine's book dies exactly the way Quine died. Tied up, guts torn out, something acidic poured over him. In the book, they eat him."
Robin stared at him. "The plates, knives and forks."
"Exactly," said Strike.
Without thinking, he pulled his mobile out of his pocket and brought up the photos he had taken, then caught sight of her frightened expression.
"No," he said. "Sorry, forgot you're not."
"Give it to me," she said. What had he forgotten? That she was not trained or experienced, not a policewoman or a soldier. She wanted to live up to his momentary forgetfulness. She wanted to step up, to be more than she was.
"I want to see," she lied.
He handed over the phone with obvious misgivings. Robin did not flinch, but as she stared at the open hole in the cadaver's chest and stomach, her own inside seemed to shrink in horror. Raising her mug to her lips, she found that she did not want to drink. The worst was the angled close-up of the face, eaten away by whatever had been poured on it, blackened, and with that burned-out eye socket. The plates struck her as an obscenity. Strike had zoomed in on one of them. The place setting had been meticulously arranged.
"My God,"
she said numbly, handing the phone back.
"Now, read this," said Strike, handing her the relevant pages.
She did so in silence. When she had finished, she looked up at him with eyes that seemed to have doubled in size.
"My God,"
she said again. Her mobile rang. She pulled it out of the handbag on the sofa beside her and looked at it. Matthew. Still furious at him, she pressed ignore.
"How many people?"
she asked Strike. Do you think I've read this book?
Could be a lot of them by now. Fisher emailed bits of it all over town. Between him and the lawyer's letters, it's become hot property.
And a strange, random thought crossed Strike's mind as he spoke. That Quine could not have arranged better publicity if he had tried. But he could not have poured acid over himself while tied up, or cut out his own guts.
It's been kept in a safe at Roper Chard that half the company seems to know the code for, he went on. That's how I got hold of it.
But don't you think the killer's likely to be someone who's in the... Robin's mobile rang again. She glanced down at it. Matthew. Again she pressed ignore.
Not necessarily, said Strike, answering her unfinished question. But the people he's written about are going to be high on the list when the police start interviewing. Of the characters I recognize, Leonora claims not to have read it, so does Catherine Kent.
Do you believe them? Asked Robin.
I believe Leonora, not sure about Catherine Kent. How did the line go? To see thee tortured would give me pleasure.
I can't believe a woman would have done that, said Robin at once, glancing at Strike's mobile, now lying on the desk between them.
Did you never hear about the Australian woman who skinned her lover, decapitated him, cooked his head and buttocks, and tried to serve him up to his kids?
You're not serious.
I'm totally serious. Look it up on the net. When women turn, they really turn, said Strike.
He was a big man.
If it was a woman he trusted, a woman he met for sex.
Who do we know for sure has read it?
Christian Fisher, Elizabeth Tassel's assistant Ralph, Tassel herself, Jerry Waldegrave, Daniel Chard. They're all characters except Ralph and Fisher. Nina Lascelles.
Who are Waldegrave and Chard? Who's Nina Lascelles?
Quine's editor, the head of his publisher, and the girl who helped me nick this, said Strike, giving the manuscript a slap.
Robin's mobile rang for the third time. Sorry, she said impatiently, and picked it up. Yes?
Robin?
Matthew's voice sounded strangely congested. He never cried, and he had never before shown himself particularly overcome by remorse at an argument. Yes, she said, a little less sharply.
Mum's had another stroke. She's...
An elevator drop in the pit of her stomach.
Matt?
He was crying.
Matt?
She repeated urgently.
She's dead,
he said, like a little boy.
I'm coming, said Robin. Where are you? I'll come now.
Strike was watching her face. He saw tidings of death there and hoped it was nobody she loved, neither of her parents, none of her brothers.
All right, she was saying, already on her feet. Stay there. I'm coming.
It's Matt's mother, she told Strike.
She's died.
It felt utterly unreal. She could not believe it.
They were only talking on the phone last night, she said.
Remembering Matt's rolling eyes and the muffled voice she had just heard, she was overwhelmed with tenderness and sympathy.
I'm so sorry, but...
Go, said Strike. Tell him I'm sorry, will you?
Yes, said Robin, trying to fasten her handbag, her fingers grown clumsy in her agitation.
She had known Mrs. Cunliffe since primary school. She slung her raincoat over her arm. The glass door flashed and closed behind her. Strike's eyes remained fixed for a few seconds on the place where Robin had vanished. Then he looked down at his watch. It was barely 9 o'clock. The brunette divorcee whose emeralds lay in his safe was due at the office in just over half an hour. He cleared and washed the mugs, then took out the necklace he had recovered, locked up the manuscript of Bombyx Murray in the safe instead, refilled the kettle, and checked his emails.
They'll postpone the wedding.
He did not want to feel glad about it. Pulling out his mobile, he called Anstis, who answered almost at once.
Bob? Anstis, I don't know whether you've already got this, but there's something you should know. Quine's last novel describes his murder.
Say that again.
Strike explained. It was clear from the brief silence after he had finished speaking that Anstis had not yet had the information.
Bob, I need a copy of that manuscript. If I send someone over...
Give me 3/4 of an hour, said Strike. He was still photocopying when his brunette client arrived.
Where's your secretary?
Were her first words, turning to him with a coquettish show of surprise, as though she was sure he had arranged for them to be alone. Off sick, diarrhea and vomiting, said Strike repressively. Shall we go through? Chapter 20. Is conscience a comrade for an old soldier? Francis Beaumont and John Fletcher, the false one. Late that evening, Strike sat alone at his desk while the traffic rumbled through the rain outside, eating Singapore noodles with one hand and scribbling a list for himself with the other. The rest of the day's work over, he was free to turn his attention fully to the murder of Owen Quine, and in his spiky, hard-to-read handwriting, was jotting down those things that must be done next. Besides some of them, he had jotted the letter A for Anstis, and if it had crossed Strike's mind that it might be considered arrogant or deluded of a private detective with no authority in the investigation to imagine he had the power to delegate tasks to the police officer in charge of the case, the thought did not trouble him. Having worked with Anstis in Afghanistan, Strike did not have a particularly high opinion of the police officer's abilities. He thought Anstis competent but unimaginative, an efficient recogniser of patterns, a reliable pursuer of the obvious. Strike did not despise these traits. The obvious was usually the answer, and the methodical ticking of boxes the way to prove it. But this murder was elaborate, strange, sadistic and grotesque, literary in inspiration, and ruthless in execution. Was Anstis capable of comprehending the mind that had nurtured a plan of murder in the fetid soil of Quine's own imagination? Strike's mobile rang, piercing in the silence. Only when he had put it to his ear and heard Leonora Quine did he realize that he had been hoping it would be Robin.
How are you? He asked.
I've had the police here, she said, cutting through the social niceties. They've been all through Owen's study. I didn't wanna, but Edna said I should let them. Can't we be left in peace after what just happened?
They've got grounds for a search, said Strike. There might be something in Owen's study that'll give him a lead on his killer.
Like what?
Well, I don't know, said Strike patiently. But I think Edna's right. It was best to let them in.
There was a silence.
Are you still there? He asked.
Yeah, she said. And now they've left it locked up so I can't get in it. And they want to come back. I don't like them being here. Orlando don't like it. One of them, she sounded outraged, asked if I wanted to move out of the house for a bit. I said, no, I bloody don't. Orlando's never stayed anywhere else. She couldn't deal with it. I'm not going anywhere.
The police haven't said they want to question you, have they?
No, she said. Only asked if they can go in the study.
Good. If they want to ask you questions...
I should get a lawyer, yeah? That's what Edna said.
Would it be all right if I come and see you tomorrow morning? He asked.
Yeah, she sounded glad. Come round 10. I need to go shopping first thing. Couldn't get out all day. I didn't want to leave them in the house without me here.
Strike hung up, reflecting again that Leonora's manner was unlikely to be standing her in good stead with the police. Would Anstis see, as Strike did, that Leonora's slight obtuseness, her failure to produce what others felt was appropriate behaviour, her stubborn refusal to look at what she did not wish to look at, arguably the very qualities that had enabled her to endure the ordeal of living with Quine, would have made it impossible for her to kill him? Or would her oddities,
her refusal to show normal grief reactions, because of an innate, though perhaps unwise honesty, caused the suspicion already lying in Anstis's mundane mind to swell, obliterating other possibilities. There was an intensity, almost a feverishness, about the way Strike returned to his scribbling, left hand still shoveling food into his mouth. Thoughts came fluently, cogently, jotting down the questions he wanted answered, locations he wanted cased, the trails he wanted followed. It was a plan of action for himself, and a means of nudging Anstis in the right direction, of helping open his eyes to the fact that it was not always the wife when a husband was killed, even if the man had been feckless, unreliable, and unfaithful. At last, Strike cast his pen down, finished the noodles in two large mouthfuls, and cleared his desk. His notes he put into the cardboard folder with Owen Quine's name on the spine, having first crossed out missing person and substituted the word murder. He turned off the lights and was on the point of locking the glass door when he thought of something and returned to Robin's computer. And there it was, on the BBC website. Not headline news, of course, because whatever Quine might have thought, he had not been a very famous man. It came three stories below the main news that the EU had agreed a bailout for the Irish Republic. The body of a man believed to be writer Owen Quine, 58, has been found in a house in Talgarth Road, London. Police have launched a murder inquiry following the discovery, which was made yesterday by a family friend. There was no photograph of Quine in his Tyrolean cloak, nor were there details of the horrors to which the body had been subjected. But it was early days. There was time. Upstairs in his flat, some of Strike's energy deserted him. He dropped onto his bed and rubbed his eyes wearily, then fell backwards and lay there fully dressed, his prosthesis still attached. Thoughts he had managed to keep at bay now pressed in upon him. Why had he not alerted the police to the fact that Quine had been missing for nearly 2 weeks? Why had he not suspected that Quine might be dead? He had had answers to these questions when D.I. Rawlins had put them to him, reasonable answers, sane answers. But he found it much more difficult to satisfy himself. He did not need to take out his phone to see Quine's body. The vision of that bound, decaying corpse seemed imprinted on his retinas. How much cunning, how much hatred, how much perversity had it taken to turn Quine's literary excrescence into reality? What kind of human being could bring themselves to slit a man open and pour acid over him, to gut him, and lay plates around his empty corpse? Strike could not rid himself of the unreasonable conviction that he ought somehow to have smelled the scene from afar, like the carrion bird he had trained to be. How had he, with his once notorious instinct for the strange, the dangerous, the suspicious, not realized that the noisy, self-dramatizing, self-publicizing Quine had been gone too long, that he was too silent?
"Because the silly bastard kept crying wolf, and because I'm knackered."
He rolled over, heaved himself off the bed, and headed for the bathroom, but his thoughts kept scurrying back to the body. The gaping hole in the torso, the burned-out eye sockets. The killer had moved around that monstrosity while it was still bleeding, when Quine's screams had perhaps barely stopped echoing through the great vaulted space and gently straightened forks. And there was another question for his list. What, if anything, had the neighbours heard of Quine's final moments? Strike got into bed at last, covered his eyes with a large hairy forearm, and listened to his own thoughts, which were gabbling at him like a workaholic twin who would not pipe down. Forensics had already had more than 24 hours. They would have formed opinions, even if all tests were not yet in. He must call Anstis, find out what they were saying.
"Enough," he told his tired, hyperactive brain. "Enough."
And by the same power of will that in the army had enabled him to fall instantly asleep on bare concrete, on rocky ground, on lumpy camp beds that squeaked rusty complaints about his bulk whenever he moved. He slid smoothly into sleep, like a warship sliding out on dark water.
Chapter 21. Is he then dead? What, dead at last? Quite forever dead? William Congreve, The Mourning Bride. At 9:15 the next morning, Strike made his way slowly down the metal stairs, asking himself, not for the first time, why he did not do something about getting the birdcage lift fixed. His knee was still sore and puffy after his fall, so he was allowing over an hour to get to Ladbroke Grove, because he could not afford to keep taking taxis. A gust of icy air stung his face as he opened the door, then everything went white as a flash went off inches from his eyes. He blinked. The outlines of three men danced in front of him. He threw up his hand against another volley of flashes.
"Why didn't you inform the police that Owen Quan was missing, Mr. Strike? Did you know he was dead, Mr. Strike?"
For a split second, he considered retreat, slamming the door on them, but that meant being trapped and having to face them later.
"No comment," he said coolly, and walked into them, refusing to alter his course by a hair's breadth,
so that they were forced to step out of his path, two asking questions and one running backwards, snapping and snapping. The girl who so often joined Strike for smoke breaks in the doorway of the guitar shop was gaping at the scene through the window.
"Why didn't you tell anyone he'd been missing for more than a fortnight, Mr. Strike?
Why didn't you notify the police?"
Strike strode in silence, his hands in his pockets and his expression grim. They scurried along beside him, trying to make him talk, a pair of razor-beaked seagulls dive-bombing a fishing trawler.
"Trying to show them up again, Mr. Strike?
Get one over on the police.
Publicity good for business, Mr. Strike."
He had boxed in the army. In his imagination, he wheeled around and delivered a left hook to the floating rib area, so that the little shit crumpled.
"Taxi!"
he shouted. Flash, flash, flash went the camera as he got into it. Thankfully, the lights ahead turned green, the taxi moved smoothly away from the curb, and they gave up running after a few steps.
"Fuckers," Strike thought, glancing over his shoulder as the taxi rounded a corner.
Some bastard at the Met must have tipped them off that he had found the body. It would not have been Anstis who had held back the information from the official statement, but one of the embittered bastards who had not forgiven him for Lula Landry.
"You famous?"
asked the cabbie, staring at him in the rearview mirror.
"No," said Strike shortly. "Drop me at Oxford Circus, will you?"
Disgruntled at such a short fare, the cabbie muttered under his breath. Strike took out his mobile and texted Robin again.
"Two journalists outside door when I left say you work for Crowdy."
Then he called Anstis.
"Bob!"
"I've just been doorstepped. They know I found the body."
"How?"
"You're asking me."
A pause.
"It was always going to come out, Bob, but I didn't give it to them." "Yeah, I saw the family friend line. They're trying to make out I didn't tell you lot because I wanted the publicity."
"Mate, I never..."
"Be good to have that rebutted by an official source, Rich. Mud sticks, and I've got a livelihood to make here."
"I'll get it done," promised Anstis. "Listen, why don't you come over for dinner tonight? Forensics have got back with their first thoughts. Be good to talk it over."
"Yeah, great," said Strike, as the taxi approached Oxford Circus. "What time?"
He remained standing on the tube train, because sitting meant having to get up again, and that put more strain on his sore knee. As he was going through Royal Oak, he felt his mobile buzz and saw two texts. The first from his sister Lucy: "Many happy returns, Stick. Kiss, kiss, kiss." He had completely forgotten that today was his birthday. He opened the second text. "Hi, Cormoran, thanks for warning about journos. Just met them. They're still hanging around the outside door. See you later. R. Kiss." Grateful that the day was temporarily dry, Strike reached the Quine house just before 10. It looked just as dingy and depressing in weak sunlight as it had the last time he had visited, but with a difference. There was a police officer standing in front of it. He was a tall young copper with a pugnacious-looking chin, and when he saw Strike walking towards him with the ghost of a limp, his eyebrows contracted.
"Can I ask who you are, sir?"
"Yeah, I expect so," said Strike, walking past him and ringing the doorbell. Anstis's dinner invitation notwithstanding, he was not feeling sympathetic to the police just now.
"Should be just about within your capabilities."
The door opened, and Strike found himself face to face with a tall, gangling girl with sallow skin, a mop of curly light brown hair, a wide mouth, and an ingenuous expression. Her eyes, which were a clear, pale green, were large and set far apart. She was wearing what was either a long sweatshirt or a short dress that ended above bony knees and fluffy pink socks, and she was cradling a large plush orangutan to her flat chest. The toy ape had Velcro attachments on its paws and was hanging around her neck.
"Hello," she said.
She swayed very gently, side to side, putting weight first on one foot, then on the other.
"Hello," said Strike. "Are you Orlan?"
"Can I have your name, please, sir?" asked the young policeman loudly.
"Yeah, all right. If I can ask why you're standing outside this house," said Strike with a smile.
"There's been press interest," said the young policeman.
"A man came," said Orlando, "and with a camera, and Mum said..."
"Orlando," called Leonora from inside the house, "what are you doing?"
She came stumping down the hall behind her daughter, gaunt and white-faced, in an ancient navy blue dress with its hem hanging down.
"Oh," she said, "it's you. Come in."
As she stepped over the threshold, Strike smiled at the policeman, who glared back.
"What's your name?"
Orlando asked Strike, as the front door closed behind them.
"Cormoran," he said.
"That's a funny name."
"Yes, it is," said Strike.
And something made him add,
"I was named after a giant."
"That's funny,"
said Orlando, swaying.
"Go in,"
said Leonora curtly, pointing Strike towards the kitchen.
"I need the loo. Be with you in a mo."
Strike proceeded down the narrow hallway. The door of the study was closed, and, he suspected, still locked. On reaching the kitchen, he discovered to his surprise that he was not the only visitor. Jerry Waldegrave, the editor from Roper Chard, was sitting at the kitchen table, clutching a bunch of flowers in somber purples and blues, his pale face anxious. A second bunch of flowers, still in its cellophane, protruded from a sink half-filled with dirty crockery. Supermarket bags of food sat unpacked on the sides.
"Hi,"
said Waldegrave, scrambling to his feet and blinking earnestly at Strike through his horn-rimmed glasses. Evidently he did not recognize the detective from their previous meeting on the dark roof garden, because he asked, as he held out his hand,
"Are you family?"
"Family friend," said Strike, as they shook hands.
"Terrible thing," said Waldegrave. "Had to come and see if I could do anything. She's been in the bathroom ever since I arrived."
"Right," said Strike.
Waldegrave resumed his seat. Orlando edged crabwise into the dark kitchen, cuddling her furry orangutan. A very long minute passed while Orlando, clearly the most at ease, unabashedly stared at both of them.
"You've got nice hair,"
she announced at last to Jerry Waldegrave.
"It's like a hairstack."
"I suppose it is," said Waldegrave, and he smiled at her.
She edged out again. Another brief silence followed, during which Waldegrave fidgeted with the flowers, his eyes darting around the kitchen.
"Can't believe it,"
he said at last. They heard the loud flushing of a toilet upstairs, a thumping on the stairs, and Leonora returned with Orlando at her heels.
Sorry, she said to the two men. I'm a bit upset.
It was obvious that she was referring to her stomach.
Look, Leonora,
said Jerry Waldegrave in an agony of awkwardness, getting to his feet.
I don't want to intrude when you've got your friend here.
Him? He's not a friend, he's a detective, said Leonora.
Sorry?
Strike remembered that Waldegrave was deaf in one ear.
He's called a name like a giant, said Orlando.
He's a detective, said Leonora loudly over her daughter.
Oh,
said Waldegrave, taken aback.
I didn't... Why?
Because I need one, said Leonora shortly.
The police think I done it to Owen.
There was a silence. Waldegrave's discomfort was palpable.
My daddy died,
Orlando informed the room. Her gaze was direct and eager, seeking a reaction. Strike, who felt that something was required of one of them, said, I know. It's very sad.
Edna said it was sad, replied Orlando, as though she had hoped for something more original, and she slid out of the room again.
Sit down, Leonora invited the two men.
They from me, she added, indicating the flowers in Waldegrave's hand.
Yes, he said, fumbling a little as he handed them over, but remaining on his feet.
Look, Leonora, I don't want to take up any of your time just now. You must be so busy with arrangements, and...
They won't let me have his body, said Leonora with devastating honesty. So I can't make no arrangements yet.
Oh, and there's a card, said Waldegrave, desperately feeling in his pockets. Here.
Well, if there's anything we can do, Leonora, anything.
Can't see what anyone can do,
said Leonora shortly, taking the envelope he proffered. She sat down at the table where Strike had already pulled up a chair, glad to take the weight off his leg.
Well, I think I'll be off. Leave you to it, said Waldegrave. Listen, Leonora, I hate to ask at a time like this, but Bombix Mori. Have you got a copy here?
No, she said. Owen took it with him.
I'm so sorry, but it would help us if... Could I have a look and see if any of it's been left behind?
She peered up at him through those huge, outdated glasses.
Police have taken everything he left, she said. They went through the study like a dose of salts yesterday. Locked it up and taken the key. I can't even go in there myself now.
Oh, well, if the police need...
No, said Waldegrave. Fair enough.
No, I'll see myself out. Don't get up. He walked up the hall, and they heard the front door close behind him.
Dunno why he came, said Leonora sullenly. Make him feel like he's done something nice, I suppose.
She opened the card he had given her. There was a watercolour of violets on the front. Inside were many signatures.
Being all nice now because they feel guilty, said Leonora, throwing the card down on the formica top table.
Guilty? They never appreciated him.
You gotta market books, she said surprisingly. You gotta promote them. It's up to the publishers to give him a push. They wouldn't never get him on TV or anything like he needed.
Strike guessed that these were complaints she had learned from her husband.
Leonora, he said, taking out his notebook. Is it all right if I ask you a couple of questions?
I suppose. I don't know nothing, though.
Have you heard from anyone who spoke to Owen or saw him after he left here on the 5th?
She shook her head.
No friends, no family.
No one, she said. Do you want a cup of tea?
Yeah, that'd be great, said Strike, who did not much fancy anything made in this grubby kitchen, but wanted to keep her talking. How well do you know the people at Owen's publisher? He asked over the noisy filling of the kettle.
She shrugged. Hardly at all. Met that Jerry when Owen done a book signing once.
You're not friendly with anyone at Ropachard.
No, why would I be? It was Owen worked with him, not me.
And you haven't read Bombix Mori, have you?
Strike asked her casually. I've told you that already. I don't like reading them till they're published. Why does everyone keep asking me that? She said, looking up from the plastic bag in which she had been rummaging for biscuits. What was the matter with the body? She demanded suddenly. What happened to him? They won't tell me. They took his toothbrush for DNA to identify him. Why won't they let me see him? He had dealt with this question before, from other wives, from distraught parents. He fell back, as so often before, on partial truth. He'd been lying there for a while, he said. How long? They don't know yet. How was it done? I don't think they know that exactly yet. But they must. She fell silent as Orlando shuffled back into the room, clutching not just her plush orangutan, but also a sheaf of brightly coloured drawings.
Where's Jerry gone?
Back to work, said Leonora.
He's got nice hair.
I don't like your hair, she told Strike.
It's fuzzy.
I don't like it much either, he said.
He don't want to look at pictures now, Dodo, said her mother impatiently. But Orlando ignored her mother and spread her paintings out on the table for Strike to see.
I did them.
They were recognizably flowers, fish, and birds. A child's menu could be read through the back of one of them.
They're very good, said Strike.
Leonora, do you know if the police found any bits of Bombyx Mori yesterday when they searched the study?
Yeah, she said, dropping tea bags into chip mugs. Two old typewriter ribbons. They'd fallen down the back of the desk. They come out and asked me where the rest of them were. I said he took them when he went.
I like Daddy's study, announced Orlando, because he gives me paper for drawing.
It's a tip, that study, said Leonora, switching the kettle on. Took him ages to look through everything.
Auntie Liz went in there, said Orlando.
When? Asked Leonora, glaring at her daughter with two mugs in her hands.
When she came and you were in the loo, said Orlando. She walked into Daddy's study. I seen her.
She don't have no right to go in there, said Leonora. Was she poking around?
No, said Orlando. She just walked in and then she walked out and she saw me and she was crying.
Yeah, said Leonora with a satisfied air. She was tearful with me and all. Another one feeling guilty.
When did she come over?
Strike asked Leonora.
First thing Monday, said Leonora. Wanted to see if she could help.
Help? She's done enough. Strike's tea was so weak and milky, it looked as though it had never known a tea bag. His preference was for a brew the colour of creosote. As he took a polite token sip, he remembered Elizabeth Tassel's avowed wish that Quine had died when her Doberman bit him.
I like her lipstick, announced Orlando.
You like everyone's everything today, said Leonora vaguely, sitting back down with her own mug of weak tea.
I asked her why she done it, why she told Owen he couldn't publish his book and upset him like that.
And what did she say? Asked Strike.
That he's gone and put a load of real people in it, said Leonora. I don't know why they're so upset about that. He always does it. She sipped her tea. He's put me in loads of them. Strike thought of Succuba, the well-worn whore, and found himself despising Owen Quine.
I wanted to ask you about Telgarth Road.
I don't know why he went there, she said immediately. He hated it. He wanted to sell it for years, but that fan court wouldn't.
Yeah, I'd been wondering about that.
Orlando had slid onto the chair beside him, one bare leg twisted underneath her as she added vibrantly coloured fins to a picture of a large fish with a pack of crayons she appeared to have pulled from thin air.
How come Michael Fancourt's been able to block the sale all these years?
It's something to do with how it was left to him by that bloke Joe. Something about how it was to be used, I dunno. You'd have to ask Liz, she knows all about it.
When was the last time Owen was there, do you know?
Years ago, she said.
I don't know, years.
I want more paper to draw,
Orlando announced.
I haven't got any more, said Leonora. It's all in Daddy's study. Use the back of this.
She seized a circular from the cluttered work surface and pushed it across the table to Orlando, but her daughter shoved it away and left the kitchen at a languid walk, the orangutan swinging from her neck. Almost at once, they heard her trying to force the door of the study.
Orlando, no!
Barked Leonora, jumping up and hurrying into the hall. Strike took advantage of her absence to lean back and pour away most of his milky tea into the sink. It spattered down the bouquet, clinging traitorously to the cellophane.
No, Dodo, you can't do that, no! We're not allowed! We're not allowed! Get off it!
A high-pitched wail and then a loud thudding proclaimed Orlando's flight upstairs. Leonora reappeared in the kitchen with a flushed face.
I'll be paying for that all day now, she said. She's unsettled. Don't like the police here.
She yawned nervously.
Have you slept? Strike asked.
Not much. Because I keep thinking, who? Who'd do it to him? He upsets people, I know that,
she said distractedly.
But that's just how he is. Temperamental. He gets angry over little things. He's always been like that. He don't mean anything by it. Who'd kill him for that?
Michael Fancourt must still have a key to the house, she went on, twisting her fingers together as she jumped subject.
I thought that last night when I couldn't sleep. I know Michael Fancourt don't like him, but that's ages ago. Anyway, Owen never did that thing Michael said he did. He never wrote it. But Michael Fancourt wouldn't kill Owen.
She looked up at Strike with clear eyes as innocent as her daughter's.
He's rich, isn't he? Famous.
He wouldn't.
Strike had always marvelled at the strange sanctity conferred upon celebrities by the public, even while the newspapers denigrated, hunted, or hounded them. No matter how many famous people were convicted of rape or murder, still the belief persisted, almost pagan in its intensity. Not him. It couldn't be him. He's famous.
And that bloody chard, burst out Leonora, sending Owen threatening letters. Owen never liked him. And then he signs the card and says if there's anything he can do. Where's that card?
The card with the picture of Violet's had vanished from the table.
She's got it, said Leonora, flushing angrily. She's taken it.
And so loudly that it made Strike jump, she bellowed, Dodo! At the ceiling. It was the irrational anger of a person in the first raw stages of grief, and like her upset stomach, revealed just how she was suffering beneath the surly surface.
Dodo!
Shouted Leonora again.
What have I told you about taking things that don't belong?
Orlando reappeared with startling suddenness in the kitchen, still cuddling her orangutan. She must have crept back down without them hearing, as quiet as a cat.
You took my card, said Leonora angrily. What have I told you about taking things that don't belong to you? Where is it?
I like the flowers, said Orlando, producing the glossy but now crumpled card which her mother snatched from her.
It's mine, she told her daughter. See, she went on, addressing Strike and pointing to the longest handwritten message, which was in precise copperplate.
Do let me know if there is anything you need, Daniel Chard.
Bloody hypocrite.
Daddy didn't like Daniel Char, said Orlando. He told me.
He's a bloody hypocrite, I know that, said Leonora, who was squinting at the other signatures.
He give me a paintbrush, said Orlando. After he touched me.
There was a short, pregnant silence. Leonora looked up at her. Strike had frozen with his mug halfway to his lips.
What?
I didn't like him touching me. What are you talking about? Who touched you? At Daddy's work.
Don't talk so silly, said her mother.
When Daddy took me and I saw...
He took her in a month ago or more because I had a doctor's appointment, Leonora told Strike, flustered, on edge.
I don't know what she's on about.
And I saw the pictures for books that they put on all coloured, said Leonora. And Daniel Chard did touch...
You don't even know who Daniel Chard is, said Leonora.
He's got no hair, said Orlando. And after Daddy took me to see the lady and I gave her my best picture, she had nice hair.
What lady? What are you talking? When Daniel Chard touched me, said Orlando loudly.
He touched me and I shouted, and after he gave me a paintbrush.
You don't want to go round saying things like that, said Leonora, and her strained voice cracked. Aren't we in enough? Don't be stupid, Orlando.
Orlando grew very red in the face. Glaring at her mother, she left the kitchen. This time she slammed the door hard behind her. It did not close, but bounced open again. Strike heard her stamping up the stairs. After a few steps, she started shrieking incomprehensibly.
Now she's upset, said Leonora dully,
and tears toppled out of her pale eyes. Strike reached over to the ragged kitchen roll on the side, ripped some off and pressed it into her hand. She cried silently, her thin shoulders shaking, and Strike sat in silence, drinking the dregs of his horrible tea.
Met Owen in a pub,
she mumbled unexpectedly, pushing up her glasses and blotting her wet face.
He was there for the festival. Hey on why? I'd never heard of him, but I could tell he was someone, way he was dressed and talking.
And a faint glow of hero worship, almost extinguished by years of neglect and unhappiness, of putting up with his airs and tantrums, of trying to pay the bills and care for their daughter in this shabby little house, flickered again behind her tired eyes. Perhaps it had rekindled because her hero, like all the best heroes, was dead. Perhaps it would burn forever now, like an eternal flame, and she would forget the worst and cherish the idea of him she had once loved, as long as she did not read his final manuscript and his vile depiction of her.
Leonora, I wanted to ask you something, Strike said gently, and then I'll be off. Have you had any more dog excrement through your letterbox in the last week?
In the last week?
She repeated thickly, still dabbing her eyes.
Yeah. Tuesday we did, I think. Or Wednesday, was it? But yeah, one more time.
And have you seen the woman you thought was following you?
She shook her head, blowing her nose.
Maybe I imagined it, I don't know.
Are you all right for money?
Yeah,
she said, blotting her eyes.
Owen had life insurance. I made him take it out because of Orlando. So we'll be all right. Edna's offered to lend me till it comes through.
Then I'll be off, said Strike, pushing himself back to his feet.
She trailed him up the dingy hall, still sniffing, and before the door had closed behind him, he heard her calling,
Dodo! Dodo, come down! I didn't mean it!
The young policeman outside stood partially blocking Strike's path. He looked angry.
I know who you are, he said.
His mobile phone was still clutched in his hand. You're Cormoran Strike.
No flies on you, are there? Said Strike. Out of the way now, sonny. Some of us have got proper work to do.
Chapter 22. What murderer, hellhound, devil can this be? Ben Jonson, Epicene, or The Silent Woman. Forgetting that getting up was the difficult part when his knee was sore, Strike dropped onto a corner seat on the tube train and rang Robin.
Hi, he said. Those journalists gone?
No, they're still hanging round outside. You're on the news, did you know?
I saw the BBC website. I rang Anstis and asked him to help play down the stuff about me, has he?
He heard her fingers tapping on the keyboard.
Yeah, he's quoted,
D.I. Richard Anstis has confirmed rumours that the body was found by private investigator Cormoran Strike, who made news earlier this year when he... Never mind that bit. Mr. Strike was employed by the family to find Mr. Quine, who often went away without informing anyone of his whereabouts. Mr. Strike is not under suspicion, and police are satisfied with his account of the discovery of the body.
Good old Dickie, said Strike. This morning they were implying I concealed bodies to drum up business. Surprise the press are this interested in a dead 58-year-old has-been. It's not as though they know how grisly the killing was yet.
It isn't Quine who's got them interested, Robin told him. It's you. The thought gave Strike no pleasure. He did not want his face in the papers or on the television. The photographs of him that had appeared in the wake of the Lula Landry case had been small. Room had been required for pictures of the stunning model, preferably partially clothed. His dark, surly features did not reproduce well in smudgy newsprint, and he had managed to avoid a full face picture as he entered court to give evidence against Landry's killer. They had dredged up old photographs of him in uniform, but these had been years old, when he had been several stone lighter. Nobody had recognized him on appearance alone since his brief burst of fame, and he had no wish to further endanger his anonymity.
I don't want to run into a bunch of hacks. Not, he added wryly, as his knee throbbed, that I could run if you paid me. Could you meet me?
His favourite local was the Tottenham, but he did not want to expose it to the possibility of future press incursions.
In the Cambridge in about 40 minutes.
No problem, she said. Only after he had hung up did it occur to Strike first that he ought to have asked after the bereaved Matthew, and second, that he ought to have asked her to bring his crutches. The 19th-century pub stood on Cambridge Circus. Strike found Robin upstairs on a leather banquette among brass chandeliers and gilt-framed mirrors.
Are you all right?
She asked in concern, as he limped towards her.
Forgot I didn't tell you, he said,
lowering himself gingerly into the chair opposite her with a groan.
I knackered my knee again on Sunday, trying to catch a woman who was following me.
What woman?
She tailed me from Quine's house to the tube station where I fell over like a tit and she took off. She matches the description of a woman Leonora says has been hanging around since Quine disappeared. I could really use a drink.
I'll get it, said Robin, as it's your birthday. And I got you a present.
She lifted onto the table a small basket covered in cellophane, adorned with ribbon and containing Cornish food and drink, beer, cider, sweets and mustard. He felt ridiculously touched.
You didn't have to do that.
But she was already out of earshot at the bar. When she returned, carrying a glass of wine and a pint of London Pride, he said,
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
So do you think this strange woman's been watching Leonora's house? Strike took a long, welcome pull on his pint.
And possibly putting dog shit through her front door, yeah, said Strike. I can't see what she had to gain from following me, though, unless she thought I was going to lead her to Quine.
He winced as he raised the damaged leg onto a stool under the table.
I'm supposed to be doing surveillance on Brocklehurst and Burnett's husband this week. Great bloody time to knacker my leg.
I could follow them for you.
The excited offer was out of Robin's mouth before she knew it, but Strike gave no evidence of having heard her.
How's Matthew doing?
Not great, said Robin. She could not decide whether Strike had registered her suggestion or not. He's gone home to be with his dad and sister.
Massam, isn't it?
Yes. She hesitated, then said, We're going to have to postpone the wedding.
Sorry.
She shrugged. We couldn't do it so soon. It's been a horrible shock for the family.
Did you get on well with Matthew's mother? Strike asked.
Yes, of course, she was... But in fact, Mrs. Cunliffe had always been difficult. A hypochondriac, or so Robin had thought.
She had been feeling guilty about that in the last 24 hours.
"Lovely," said Robin.
"So how's poor Mrs. Quine doing?"
Strike described his visit to Leonora, including the brief appearance of Jerry Waldegrave and his impressions of Orlando.
"What exactly is wrong with her?" Robin asked.
"Learning difficulties, they call it, don't they?"
He paused, remembering Orlando's ingenuous smile, her cuddly orangutan.
"She said something strange while I was there, and it seemed to be news to her mother. She told us she went into work with her father once, and that the head of Quine's publisher touched her. Name of Daniel Chard."
He saw reflected in Robin's face the unacknowledged fear that the words had conjured back in the dingy kitchen.
"How touched her?"
"She wasn't specific. She said, 'He touched me, and I don't like being touched,' and that he gave her a paintbrush after he'd done it."
"It might not be that," said Strike, in response to Robin's loaded silence, her tense expression.
"He might have accidentally knocked into her and given her something to placate her. She kept going off on one while I was there, shrieking because she didn't get what she wanted or her mum had a go at her."
Hungry, he tore open the cellophane on Robin's gift, pulled out a chocolate bar and unwrapped it, while Robin sat in thoughtful silence.
"Thing is," said Strike, breaking the silence, "Quine implied in Bombix Mori that Chard's gay. I think that's what he's saying, anyway."
"Hmm," said Robin, unimpressed. "And do you believe everything Quine wrote in that book?"
"Well, judging by the fact that he set lawyers on Quine, it upset Chard," said Strike, breaking off a large chunk of chocolate and putting it in his mouth. "Mind you," he continued thickly, "the Chard in Bombix Mori's a murderer, possibly a rapist, and his knob's falling off. So the gay stuff might not have been what got his goat."
"It's a constant theme in Quine's work, sexual duality," said Robin. And Strike stared at her, chewing, his brows raised. "I nipped into Foyle's on the way to work and bought a copy of Hobart's Sin," she explained. "It's all about a hermaphrodite." Strike swallowed.
"He must have a thing about them. There's one in Bombix Mori too," he said, examining the cardboard covering of his chocolate bar. "This was made in Mullion. That's down the coast from where I grew up."
"How's Hobart's Sin? Any good?"
"I wouldn't be fussed about reading past the first few pages if its author hadn't just been murdered," admitted Robin.
"Probably do wonders for his sales, get him bumped off."
"My point is," Robin pressed on doggedly, "that you can't necessarily trust Quine when it comes to other people's sex lives, because his characters all seem to sleep with anyone and anything. I looked him up on Wikipedia. One of the key features of his books is how characters keep swapping their gender or sexual orientation."
"Bombix Mori's like that," grunted Strike, helping himself to more chocolate. "This is good. Want a bit?"
"I'm supposed to be on a diet," said Robin sadly, "for the wedding."
Strike did not think she needed to lose any weight at all, but said nothing as she took a piece.
"I've been thinking," said Robin diffidently, "about the killer."
"Always keen to hear from the psychologist. Go on."
"I'm not a psychologist," she half laughed.
She had dropped out of her psychology degree. Strike had never pressed her for an explanation, nor had she ever volunteered one. It was something they had in common, dropping out of university. He had left when his mother had died of a mysterious overdose, and perhaps because of this, he had always assumed that something traumatic had made Robin leave too.
"I've just been wondering why they tied his murder so obviously to the book. On the surface, it looks like a deliberate act of revenge and malice, to show the world that Quine got what he deserved for writing it."
"Looks like that," agreed Strike, who was still hungry.
He reached over to a neighbouring table and plucked a menu off it.
"I'm going to have steak and chips. Want something?"
Robin chose a salad at random, and then, to spare Strike's knee, went up to the bar to give their order.
But on the other hand, Robin continued, sitting back down, copycatting the last scene of the book could have seemed like a good way of concealing a different motive, couldn't it? She was forcing herself to speak matter-of-factly, as though they were discussing an abstract problem, but Robin had not been able to forget the pictures of Quine's body. The dark cavern of the gouged-out torso, the burned-out crevices where once had been mouth and eyes. If she thought about what had been done to Quine too much, she knew that she might not be able to eat her lunch, or that she might somehow betray her horror to Strike, who was watching her with a disconcertingly shrewd expression in his dark eyes.
"It's all right to admit what happened to him makes you want to puke," he said, through a mouthful of chocolate.
"It doesn't," she lied automatically. Then, "Well, obviously. I mean, it was horrific."
"Yeah, it was."
If he had been back with his SIB colleagues, he would have been making jokes about it by now. Strike could remember many afternoons laden with pitch-black humour. It was the only way to get through certain investigations. Robin, however, was not yet ready for a professionally callous self-defence, and her attempt at dispassionate discussion of a man whose guts had been torn out proved it.
"Motive's a bitch, Robin. 9 times out of 10 you only find out why when you found out who. It's means and opportunity we want. Personally," he took a gulp of beer, "I think we might be looking for someone with medical knowledge."
"Medical
or anatomical. It didn't look amateur, what they did to Quine. They could have hacked him to bits trying to remove the intestines, but I couldn't see any false starts. One clean, confident incision."
"Yes," said Robin, struggling to maintain her objective, clinical manner. "That's true.
Unless we're dealing with some literary maniac who just got hold of a good textbook," mused Strike. "Seems a stretch, but you don't know. If he was tied up and drugged, and they had enough nerve, they might have been able to treat it like a biology lesson."
Robin could not restrain herself. "I know you always say motives for lawyers," she said a little desperately. Strike had repeated this maxim many times since she had come to work for him. "But humour me for a moment. The killer must have felt that to murder Quine in the same way as the book was worth it for some reason that outweighed the obvious disadvantages."
"Which were?"
"Well," said Robin, "the logistical difficulties of making it such an elaborate killing, and the fact that the pool of suspects would be confined to people who've read the book."
"Or heard about it in detail," said Strike. "And you say confined, but I'm not sure we're looking at a small number of people. Christian Fisher made it his business to spread the contents of the book as far and wide as he could. Rope a charged copy of the manuscript was in a safe, to which half the company seems to have had access."
"But," said Robin. She broke off as a sullen barman came over to dump cutlery and paper napkins on their table. "But," she resumed when he had sloped away, "Quine can't have been killed that recently, can he? I mean, I'm no expert."
"Nor am I," said Strike, polishing off the last of the chocolate and contemplating the peanut brittle with less enthusiasm. "But I know what you mean. That body looked as though it had been there at least a week."
"Plus," said Robin, "there must have been a time lag between the murderer reading Bombix Mori and actually killing Quine. There was a lot to organise. They had to get ropes and acid and crockery into an uninhabited house.
And unless they already knew he was planning to go to Talgarth Road, they had to track Quine down," said Strike,
deciding against the peanut brittle because his steak and chips were approaching, "or lure him there." The barman set down Strike's plate and Robin's bowl of salad, greeted their thanks with an indifferent grunt, and retreated.
"So when you factor in the planning and practicalities, it doesn't seem possible that the killer can have read the book any later than 2 or 3 days after Quine went missing," said Strike, loading up his fork. "Trouble is,
The further back we set the moment when the killer started plotting Quine's murder, the worse it looks for my client. All Leonora had to do was walk a few steps up her hall. The manuscript was hers for the reading as soon as Quine finished it. Come to think of it, he could have told her how he was planning to end it months ago.
Robin ate her salad without tasting it.
And does Leonora Quine seem...
she began tentatively.
Like the kind of woman who'd disembowel her husband?
No.
But the police fancy her, and if you're looking for motive, she's lousy with it. He was a crap husband, unreliable, adulterous, and he liked depicting her in disgusting ways in his books.
You don't think she did it, do you?
No, Strike said. But we're going to need a lot more than my opinion to keep her out of jail.
Robin took their empty glasses back to the bar for refills without asking. Strike felt very fond of her as she set another pint in front of him.
We've also got to look at the possibility that somebody got the wind up that Quine was going to self-publish over the internet, said Strike, shoveling chips into his mouth. A threat he allegedly made to a packed restaurant. That might constitute a motive for killing Quine, under the right conditions.
You mean, said Robin slowly, if the killer recognized something in the manuscript that they didn't want to get a wider audience?
Exactly. The book's pretty cryptic in parts. What if Quine had found out something serious about somebody and put a veiled reference in the book?
Well, that would make sense, said Robin slowly. Because I keep thinking, why kill him?
The fact is, nearly all of these people had more effective means of dealing with the problem of a libelous book, didn't they? They could have told Quine they wouldn't represent it or publish it, or they could have threatened it with legal action, like this charred man. His death's going to make the situation much worse for anyone who's a character in the book, isn't it? There's already much more publicity than there would have been otherwise.
Agreed, said Strike. But you're assuming the killer's thinking rationally.
This wasn't a crime of passion, retorted Robin. They planned it. They really thought it through. They must have been ready for the consequences.
True again, said Strike, eating chips.
I'd been having a bit of a look at Bombix Murray this morning.
After you got bored with Hobart Sin?
Yes. Well, it was there in the safe and...
Read the whole thing, the more the merrier, said Strike. How far did you get?
I skipped around, said Robin. I read the bit about Succuba and the Tick. It's spiteful, but it doesn't feel as though there's anything, well, hidden there. He's basically accusing both his wife and his agent of being parasites on him, isn't he? Strike nodded. But later on, when you get to how do you say it?
Epicene, the hermaphrodite.
Is that a real person, do you think? What's with the singing? It doesn't feel as though it's really singing he's talking about, does it?
And why does his girlfriend Harpy live in a cave full of rats? Symbolism or something else?
And the bloodstained bag over the cutter's shoulder, said Robin, and the dwarf he tries to drown.
And the brands in the fire at Vainglorious's house, said Strike.
But she looked puzzled.
You haven't got that far.
But Jerry Waldegrave explained that to a bunch of us at the Roper Chard party. It's about Michael Fancourt and his first... Strike's mobile rang. He pulled it out and saw Dominic Culpepper's name. With a small sigh, he answered.
Strike?
Speaking. What the fuck's going on?
Strike did not waste time pretending not to know what Culpepper was talking about.
Can't discuss it, Culpepper. Could prejudice the police case.
Fuck that. We've got a copper talking to us already. He says this Quine's been slaughtered exactly the way a bloke's killed in his latest book.
Yeah? And how much are you paying the stupid bastard to shoot his mouth off and screw up the case?
Bloody hell, Strike. You get mixed up in a murder like this, and you don't even think of ringing me.
I don't know what you think our relationship is about, mate, said Strike. But as far as I'm concerned, I do jobs for you and you pay me. That's it.
I put you in touch with Nina so you could get in that publisher's party.
The least you could do after I handed you a load of extra stuff you'd never asked for on Parker, said Strike, spearing stray chips with his free hand. I could have withheld that and shopped it all around the tabloids.
If you want paying...
No, I don't want paying, dickhead, said Strike irritably,
as Robin turned her attention tactfully to the BBC website on her phone.
I'm not going to help screw up a murder investigation by dragging in the news of the world.
I could get you 10 grand if you throw in a personal interview.
Bye, Culp.
Wait. Just tell me which book it is. The one where he describes the murder.
Strike pretended to hesitate.
The Brothers Balls. Balzac, he said.
Smirking, he cut the call and reached for the menu to examine the puddings. Hopefully Culpepper would spend a long afternoon wading through tortured syntax and palpated scrotums.
Anything new?
Strike asked as Robin looked up from her phone. Not unless you count the Daily Mail saying that family friends thought Pippa Middleton would make a better marriage than Kate.
Strike frowned at her.
I was just looking at random things while you were on the phone, said Robin, a little defensively.
No, said Strike. Not that. I've just remembered. Pippa 2011.
I don't, said Robin, confused, and still thinking of Pippa Middleton.
Pippa 2011, on Catherine Kent's blog. She claimed to have heard a bit of Bombix Mori.
Robin gasped and set to work on her mobile.
It's here, she said a few minutes later. What would you say if I told you he'd read it to me?
And that was, Robin scrolled upwards, on October the 21st.
October the 21st? She might have known the ending before Quine even disappeared.
That's right, said Strike. I'm having apple crumble. Want anything?
When Robin had returned from placing yet another order at the bar, Strike said,
Anstis has asked me to dinner tonight. Says he's got some preliminary stuff in from forensics.
Does he know it's your birthday? Asked Robin.
Christ, no, said Strike.
And he sounded so revolted by the idea that Robin laughed.
Why would that be bad?
I've already had one birthday dinner, said Strike darkly. Best present I could get from Anstis would be a time of death. The earlier they set it, the smaller the number of likely suspects. The ones who got their hands on the manuscript early. Unfortunately, that includes Leonora. But you've got this mysterious Pipper, Christian Fisher.
Why Fisher?
Means and opportunity, Robin. He had early access, he's got to go on the list. Then there's Elizabeth Tassel's assistant Ralph, Elizabeth Tassel herself, and Jerry Waldegrave. Daniel Chard presumably saw it shortly after Waldegrave. Catherine Kent denies reading it, but I'm taking that with a barrel of salt. And then there's Michael Fancourt.
Robin looked up, startled.
How can he...
Strike's mobile rang again. It was Nina Lascelles. He hesitated, but the reflection that her cousin might have told her he had just spoken to Strike persuaded him to take the call.
Hi,
he said.
Hi, famous person, she said.
He heard an edge inexpertly covered by breathy high spirits.
I've been too scared to call you in case you're being inundated with press calls and groupies and things.
Not so much, said Strike. Our things are rope-a-charred.
Insane. Nobody's doing any work. It's all we can talk about. Was it really, honestly, murder?
Looks like it.
God, I can't believe it. I don't suppose you can tell me anything, though?
She asked, barely suppressing the interrogative note.
The police won't want details getting out at this stage.
It was to do with a book, wasn't it? She said. Bombix Mori.
I couldn't say.
And Daniel Chard's broken his leg.
Sorry, he said,
thrown by the non sequitur.
Just so many odd things happening, she said. She sounded keyed up,
overwrought. Jerry's all over the place. Daniel rang him up from Devon just now and was yelling at him again. Half the office heard because Jerry put him on speakerphone by accident and then couldn't find the button to turn him off. He can't leave his weekend house because of his broken leg. Daniel, I mean.
Why was he yelling at Waldegrave?
Security on Bombix, she said. The police have got a full copy of the manuscript from somewhere, and Daniel's not happy about it. Anyway, she said, I just thought I'd ring and say congrats.
I suppose you congratulate a detective when they find a body, or don't you?
Call me when you're not so busy.
She rang off before he could say anything else. Nina Lascelles, he said as the waiter reappeared with his apple crumble and a coffee for Robin. The girl...
Who stole the manuscript for you, said Robin.
Your memory would have been wasted in HR, said Strike, picking up his spoon.
Are you serious about Michael Fancourt? She asked quietly.
Course, said Strike. Daniel Chard must have told him what Quine had done. He wouldn't have wanted Fancourt to hear it from anyone else, would he? Fancourt's a major acquisition for them. No, I think we've got to assume that Fancourt knew early on what was in.
Now Robin's mobile rang. Hi, said Matthew.
Hi, how are you?
She asked anxiously.
Not great.
Somewhere in the background, someone turned up the music. First day that I saw you, thought you were beautiful.
Where are you? Asked Matthew sharply. Oh, in a pub, said Robin.
Suddenly the air seemed full of pub noises, clinking glasses, raucous laughter from the bar.
It's Cormoran's birthday, she said anxiously.
After all, Matthew and his colleagues went to the pub on each other's birthdays.
That's nice, said Matthew, sounding furious. I'll call you later. Matt, no, wait.
Mouth full of apple crumble, Strike watched out of the corner of his eye as she got up and moved away to the bar without explanation, evidently trying to redial Matthew. The accountant was unhappy that his fiancée had gone out to lunch, that she was not sitting Shiva for his mother. Robin redialed and redialed. She got through at last. Strike finished both his crumble and his third pint and realized that he needed the bathroom. His knee, which had not troubled him much while he ate, drank and talked to Robin, complained violently when he stood. By the time he got back to his seat, he was sweating a little with the pain. Judging by the expression on her face, Robin was still trying to placate Matthew. When at last she hung up and rejoined him, he returned a short answer to whether or not he was all right.
You know, I could follow the Brocklehurst girl for you, she offered again. If your legs too...
No, snapped Strike.
He felt sore, angry with himself, irritated by Matthew, and suddenly a bit nauseous. He ought not to have eaten the chocolate before having steak, chips, crumble, and three pints.
I need you to go back to the office and type up Gonfrey's last invoice, and text me if those bloody journalists are still around, because I'll go straight from here to Anstice's if they are.
We really need to be thinking about taking someone else on, he added under his breath.
Robin's expression hardened.
I'll go and get typing then, she said.
She snatched up her coat and bag and left. Strike caught a glimpse of her angry expression, but an irrational vexation prevented him from calling her back.
Chapter 23. For my part, I do not think she hath a soul so black to act a deed so bloody. John Webster, The White Devil. An afternoon in the pub, with his leg propped up, had not much reduced the swelling in Strike's knee. After buying painkillers and a cheap bottle of red wine on the way to the tube, he set out for Greenwich, where Anstice lived with his wife Helen, commonly known as Helly. The journey to their house in Ashburnham Grove took him over an hour due to a delay on the Central line. He stood the whole way, keeping his weight on his left leg, regretting anew the £100 he had spent on taxis to and from Lucy's house. By the time he got off the Docklands Light Railway, spots of rain were again peppering his face. He turned up his collar and limped away into the darkness for what should have been a 5-minute walk, but which took him nearly 15. Only as he turned the corner into the neat terrace street, with its well-tended front gardens, did it occur to Strike that he ought, perhaps, to have brought a gift for his godson. He felt as little enthusiasm for the social part of the evening ahead as he felt eager to discuss with Anstis the forensic information. Strike did not like Anstis's wife. Her nosiness was barely concealed beneath a sometimes cloying warmth. It emerged from time to time like a flick knife flashing suddenly from beneath a fur coat. She gushed gratitude and solicitousness every time Strike swam into her orbit. But he could tell that she itched for details of his checkered past, for information about his rock star father, his dead drug-taking mother, and he could well imagine that she would yearn for details of his breakup with Charlotte, whom she had always treated with an effusiveness that failed to mask dislike and suspicion. At the party following the christening of Timothy Cormoran Anstis, which had been postponed until he was 18 months old, because his father and godfather had to be airlifted out of Afghanistan and discharged from their respective hospitals, Helly had insisted on making a tearful, tipsy speech about how Strike had saved her baby's daddy's life and how much it meant to her to have him agree to be Timmy's guardian angel, too. Strike, who had not been able to think of any valid reason to refuse being the boy's godfather, had stared at the tablecloth while Helly spoke, careful not to meet Charlotte's eye in case she made him laugh. She had been wearing, he remembered it vividly, his favourite peacock blue wrap-over dress, which had clung to every inch of her perfect figure. Having a woman that beautiful on his arm, even while he was still on crutches, had acted as a counterweight to the half a leg still not yet fit for a prosthesis. It had transformed him from man with only one foot to the man who had managed, miraculously, as he knew nearly every man who came into contact with her must think, to snag a fiancée so stunning that men stopped talking in mid-sentence when she entered the room. "Call me darling," crooned Helly when she opened the door. "Look at you, all famous. We thought you'd forgotten us." Nobody else ever called him Cormy. He had never bothered to tell her he disliked it. She treated him, without encouragement, to a tender hug that he knew was intended to suggest pity and regret for his single status. The house was warm and brightly lit after the hostile winter night outside, and he was glad to see, as he extricated himself from Helly, Anstis stride into view, holding a pint of Doom Bar as a welcoming gift. "Richie, let him get inside, honestly." But Strike had accepted the pint and taken several grateful mouthfuls before he bothered to take off his coat. Strike's 3.5-year-old godson burst into the hall, making shrill engine noises. He was very like his mother, whose features, small and pretty though they were oddly bunched up in the middle of her face. Timothy sported Superman pajamas and was swiping at the walls with a plastic lightsaber. "Oh, Timmy, darling, don't! Our lovely new paintwork!" He wanted to stay up and see his Uncle Cormoran. "We tell him about you all the time," said Helly. Strike contemplated the small figure without enthusiasm, detecting very little reciprocal interest from his godson. Timothy was the only child Strike knew whose birthday he had a hope of remembering, not that this ever led Strike to buy him a present. The boy had been born 2 days before the Viking had exploded on that dusty road in Afghanistan, taking with it Strike's lower right leg and part of Anstis's face. Strike had never confided in anyone how, during long hours in his hospital bed, he had wondered why it had been Anstis he had grabbed and pulled towards the back of the vehicle. He had gone over it in his mind, the strange presentiment amounting almost to certainty that they were about to explode, and the reaching out and seizing of Anstis, when he could equally have grabbed Sergeant Gary Topley. Was it because Anstis had spent most of the previous day Skyping Helen within earshot of Strike, looking at the newborn son he might otherwise never have met? Was that why Strike's hand had reached, without hesitation, for the older man, the territorial army policeman, and not Redcap Topley, engaged but childless? Strike did not know. He was not sentimental about children, and he disliked the wife he had saved from widowhood. He knew himself to be merely one among millions of soldiers, dead and living, whose split-second actions, prompted by instinct as much as training, had forever altered other men's fates.
"Do you want to read Tim a bedtime story, Cormie? We've got a new book, haven't we, Timmy?"
Strike could think of little he wanted to do less, especially if it involved the hyperactive boy sitting on his lap and perhaps kicking his right knee. Anstis led the way into the open-plan kitchen and dining area. The walls were cream, the floorboards bare, a long wooden table stood near French windows at the end of the room, surrounded by chairs upholstered in black. Strike had the vague idea that they had been a different colour when he had last been there, with Charlotte. Helly bustled in behind them and thrust a highly coloured picture book into Strike's hands. He had no choice but to sit down on a dining room chair, with his godson placed firmly beside him, and to read the story of Kyla the Kangaroo, who loved to bounce, which was, as he would not usually have noticed, published by Roper Chard. Timothy did not appear remotely interested in Kyla's antics, and played with his lightsaber throughout.
"Bedtime, Timmy. Give Cormie a kiss," Helly told her son,
who, with Strike's silent blessing, merely wriggled off his chair and ran out of the kitchen yelling protests. Helly followed. Mother and son's raised voices grew muffled as they thumped upstairs.
"He'll wake Tilly," predicted Anstis. And sure enough, when Helly reappeared, it was with a howling one-year-old in her arms, whom she thrust at her husband before turning to the oven. Strike sat stolidly at the kitchen table, growing steadily hungrier and feeling profoundly grateful that he did not have children. It took nearly 3/4 of an hour for the Anstises to persuade Tilly back into her bed. At last the casserole reached the table and, with it, another pint of Doom Bar. Strike could have relaxed, but for the sense that Helly Anstis was now gearing up for the attack.
"I was so, so sorry to hear about you and Charlotte," she told him. His mouth was full, so he mimed vague appreciation of her sympathy.
"Richie," she said playfully, as her husband made to pour her a glass of wine.
"I don't think so."
"We're expecting again," she told Strike proudly, one hand on her stomach. He swallowed.
"Congratulations," he said, staggered that they looked so pleased at the prospect of another Timothy or Tilly.
Right on cue, their son reappeared and announced that he was hungry. To Strike's disappointment, it was Anstis who left the table to deal with him, leaving Helly staring beadily at Strike over a forkful of beef bourguignon.
"So she's getting married on the 4th. I can't even imagine what that feels like for you."
"Who's getting married?" Strike asked.
Helly looked amazed.
"Charlotte," she said.
Dimly, down the stairs, came the sound of his godson wailing.
"Charlotte's getting married on the 4th of December," said Helly.
And with her realization that she was the first to give him the news, came a look of burgeoning excitement. But then something in Strike's expression seemed to unnerve her.
I heard," she said, dropping her gaze to her plate as Anstis returned.
"Little bugger," he said. "I've told him I'll smack his bum for him if he gets out of bed again."
"He's just excited," said Helly,
who still seemed flustered by the anger she had sensed in Strike.
"Because Cormie's here."
The casserole had turned to rubber and polystyrene in Strike's mouth. How could Helly Anstis know when Charlotte was getting married? the Anstices hardly moved in the same circles as her or her future husband, who, as Strike despised himself for remembering, was the son of the 14th Viscount of Croy. What did Helly Anstice know about the world of private gentlemen's clubs, of Savile Row tailoring, and coked-up supermodels of which the Honourable Jago Ross had been a habitué all his trust-funded life? She knew no more than Strike himself. Charlotte, to whom it was native territory, had joined Strike in a social no-man's land when they had been together, a place where neither was comfortable with the other's social set, where two utterly disparate norms collided, and everything became a struggle for common ground. Timothy was back in the kitchen, crying hard. Both his parents stood up this time and jointly moved him back towards his bedroom, while Strike, hardly aware that they had gone, was left to disappear into a fug of memories. Charlotte had been volatile to the point that one of her stepfathers had once tried to have her committed. She lied as other women breathed. She was damaged to her core. The longest consecutive period that she and Strike had ever managed together was 2 years. Yet as often as their trust in each other had splintered, they had been drawn back together, each time, so it seemed to Strike, more fragile than they had been before, but with the longing for each other strengthening. For 16 years, Charlotte had defied the disbelief and disdain of her family and friends to return, over and over again, to a large, illegitimate, and latterly disabled soldier. Strike would have advised any friend to leave and not look back, but he had come to see her like a virus in his blood that he doubted he would ever eradicate. The best he could hope for was to control its symptoms. The final breach had come 8 months previously, just before he had become newsworthy through the Landry case. She had finally told an unforgivable lie. He had left her for good, and she had retreated into a world where men still went grouse shooting and women had tiaras in the family vault. A world she had told him she despised, although it looked as though that had been a lie too. The Anstices returned, minus Timothy, but with a sobbing and hiccuping Tilly.
"Bet you're glad you haven't got any, aren't you?" said Helly gaily, sitting back down at the table with Tilly on her lap.
Strike grinned humorlessly and did not contradict her. There had been a baby. Or more accurately, the ghost, the promise of a baby, and then, supposedly, the death of a baby. Charlotte had told him that she was pregnant, refused to consult a doctor, changed her mind about dates, then announced that all was over without a shred of proof that it had ever been real. It was a lie most men would have found impossible to forgive, and for Strike it had been, as surely as she must have known, the lie to end all lies, and the death of that tiny amount of trust that had survived years of her mythomania. Marrying on the 4th of December, in 11 days' time. How could Helly Anstice know? He was perversely grateful now for the whining and tantrums of the two children, which effectively disrupted conversation all through a pudding of rhubarb flan and custard. Anstice's suggestion that they take fresh beers into his study to go over the forensic report was the best Strike had heard all day. They left a slightly sulky Helly, who clearly felt she had not had her money's worth out of Strike, to manage the now very sleepy Tilly and the unnervingly wide-awake Timothy, who had reappeared to announce that he had spilled his drinking water all over his bed. Anstice's study was a small, book-lined room off the hall. He offered Strike the computer chair and sat on an old futon. The curtains were not drawn. Strike could see a misty rain falling like dust motes in the light of an orange street lamp. "Forensics say it's hard jobs they've ever had," Anstice began, and Strike's attention was immediately all his. "All this is unofficial, mind. We haven't got everything in yet." "Have they been able to tell what actually killed him?"
"Blow to the head,"
said Anstice. The back of his skull's been stoved in. It might not have been instantaneous, but the brain trauma alone would have killed him. They can't be sure he was dead when he was carved open, but he was almost certainly unconscious. Small mercies. Any idea whether he was tied up before or after he was knocked out? There's some argument about that. There's a patch of skin under the ropes on one of his wrists that's bruised, which they think indicates he was tied up before he was killed, but we've no indication whether he was still conscious when the ropes were put on him. The problem is, all that bloody acid everywhere has taken away any marks on the floor that might have shown a struggle, or the body being dragged. He was a big, heavy guy. Easier to handle if he was trussed up, agreed Strike, thinking of short, thin Leonora. But it'd be good to know the angle he was hit at. From just above, said Anstice. But as we don't know whether he was hit standing, sitting, or kneeling, I think we can be sure he was killed in that room, said Strike, following his own train of thought. I can't see anyone being strong enough to carry a body that heavy up those stairs. The consensus is that he died more or less on the spot where the body was found. That's where the greatest concentration of the acid is. Do you know what kind of acid it was? Oh, didn't I say? Hydrochloric. Strike struggled to remember something of his chemistry lessons. Don't they use that to galvanize steel? Among other things. It's as caustic a substance as you can legally buy, and it's used in a load of industrial processes. Heavy-duty cleaning agent as well. One weird thing about it is, it occurs naturally in humans. It's our gastric acid. Strike sipped his beer, considering. In the book, they pour vitriol on him. Vitriol's sulfuric acid, and hydrochloric acid derives from it. Seriously corrosive to human tissue, as you saw. Where the hell did the killer get that amount of the stuff? Believe it or not, it looks like it was already in the house. Why the hell? Still haven't found anyone who can tell us. There were empty gallon containers on the kitchen floor, and dusty containers of the same description in a cupboard under the stairs, full of the stuff and unopened. They came from an industrial chemicals company in Birmingham. There were marks on the empty ones that looked as though they'd been made by gloved hands. Very interesting, said Strike, scratching his chin. We're still trying to check when and how they were bought. What about the blunt object that bashed his head in? There's an old-fashioned doorstop in the studio, solid iron and shaped like one, with a handle, almost certainly that. It fits with the impression in his skull. That's had hydrochloric acid poured all over it like nearly everything else. How's the time of death looking? Yeah, well, that's the tricky bit. The entomologist won't commit himself, says the condition of the corpse throws out all the usual calculations. The fumes from the hydrochloric acid alone would have kept insects away for a while, so you can't date the death from infestation. No self-respecting blowfly wants to lay eggs in acid. We had a maggot or two on bits of the body that weren't doused in the stuff, but the usual infestation didn't occur. Meanwhile, the heating in the house had been cranked right up, so the body might have rotted a bit faster than it would ordinarily have done in this weather. But the hydrochloric acid would have tended to mess with normal decomposition. Parts of him are burnt to the bone. The deciding factor would have been the guts, last meal and so on. But they'd been lifted clean out of the body. Looks like they left with the killer, said Anstice. I've never heard of that being done before. Have you? Pounds of raw intestine taken away. No, said Strike. It's a new one on me. Bottom line, forensics are refusing to commit themselves to a time frame, except to say he's been dead at least 10 days. But I had a private word with Underhill, who's the best of them, and he told me off the record that he thinks Quine's been dead a good 2 weeks. He reckons, though, even when they've got everything in, the evidence will still be equivocal enough to give defending counsel a lot to play with. And what about pharmacology? Asked Strike. His thoughts circling back to Quine's bulk, the difficulty of handling a body that big. Well, he might have been drugged, agreed Anstice. We haven't had blood results back yet, and we're analysing the contents of the bottles in the kitchen as well. But... He finished his beer and set down the glass with a flourish. There's another way he could have made things easy for a killer. Quine liked being tied up. Sex games.
How do you know that?
The girlfriend, said Anstis, Catherine Kent.
You've already talked to her, have you?
Yep, said Anstis. We found a taxi driver who picked up Quine at 9 o'clock on the 5th, a couple of streets away from his house, and dropped him in Lily Road.
Right by Stafford Cripp's house, said Strike.
So he went straight from Leonora to the girlfriend. Well, no, he didn't. Kent was away, staying with her dying sister, and we've got corroboration. She spent the night at the hospice. She says she hasn't seen him for a month, but was surprisingly forthcoming on their sex life.
Did you ask for details?
Well, I got the impression she thought we knew more than we did. They came pouring out without much prodding.
Suggestive, said Strike. She told me she'd never read Bombyx Mori.
She told us that too.
But her character ties up and assaults the hero in the book. Maybe she wanted it on record that she ties people up for sex, not torture or murder.
What about the copy of the manuscript Leonora says he took away with him? All the notes and the old typewriter ribbons. Did you find them?
Nope, said Anstis.
Until we find out whether he stayed somewhere else before he went to Talgarth Road, we're going to assume the killer took them. The place was empty except for a bit of food and drink in the kitchen and a camping mattress and sleeping bag in one of the bedrooms. It looks like Quine was dossing down there. Hydrochloric acid's been poured around that room too, all over Quine's bed.
No fingerprints, footprints, unexplained hair, mud?
Nothing. We've still got people working on the place, but the acid's obliterated everything in its path. Our people are wearing masks just so the fumes don't rip their throats out. Anyone apart from this taxi driver admitted to seeing Quine since he disappeared.
Nobody's seen him enter in Talgarth Road, but we've got a neighbour at number 183 who swears she saw Quine leave it at 1 in the morning, early hours of the 6th. The neighbour was letting herself in after a bonfire night party.
It was dark and she was 2 doors down. So what she actually saw was...
silhouette of a tall figure in a cloak, carrying a holdall.
A holdall? Repeated Strike.
Yep,
said Anstis.
Did the cloak figure get into a car?
No, it walked out of sight, but obviously a car could have been parked round the corner.
Anyone else?
I've got an old geezer in Putney swearing he saw Quine on the 8th, rang his local police station and described him accurately.
What was Quine doing?
Buying books in the Bridlington bookshop, where the bloke works.
How convincing a witness is he?
Well, he's old, but he claims he can remember what Quine bought and the physical description's good. And we've got another woman who lives in the flats across the road from the crime scene, who reckons she passed Michael Fancourt walking past the house, also on the morning of the 8th. You know, the author with the big head, famous one.
Yeah, I do, said Strike slowly.
Witness claims she looked back at him over her shoulder and stared, because she recognised him.
He was just walking past, so she claims.
Anybody checked that with Fancourt yet? He's in Germany, but he said he's happy to cooperate with us when he gets back. Agent bending over backwards to be helpful.
Any other suspicious activity around Talgarth Road? Camera footage?
The only camera's at the wrong angle for the house. It watches traffic. But I'm saving the best till last. We've got a different neighbour. Other side, 4 doors down, who swears he saw a fat woman in a burqa letting herself in on the afternoon of the 4th, carrying a plastic bag from a halal takeaway. He says he noticed because the house had been empty so long. He claims she was there for an hour, then left.
He's sure she was in Quine's house,
so he says.
And she had a key.
That's his story.
A burqa, repeated Strike. Bloody hell.
I wouldn't swear his eyesight's great. He's got very thick lenses in his glasses. He told me he didn't know of any Muslims living in the street, so it had caught his attention.
So, we've got two alleged sightings of Quine since he walked out on his wife, early hours of the 6th and on the 8th, in Putney.
Yeah, said Anstice. But I wouldn't pin too much hope on either of them, bub.
You think he died the night he left, said Strike. More statement than question.
And Anstice nodded.
Underhill thinks so. No sign of a knife?
Nothing. The only knife in the kitchen was a very blunt, everyday one. Definitely not up to the job.
Who do we know had a key to the place?
Your client, said Anstice, obviously. Quine himself must have had one. Fancourt's got two. He's already told us that by phone. The Quines lent one to his agent when she was organising some repairs for them. She says she gave it back. A next-door neighbour's got a key so he can let himself in if anything goes wrong with the place.
Didn't he go in once the stink got bad?
One side did put a note through the door complaining about the smell, but the keyholder left for 2 months in New Zealand a fortnight ago. We've spoken to him by phone. Last time he was in the house was in about May, when he took delivery of a couple of packages while some workmen were in and put them in the hall. Mrs. Quine's vague about who else might have been lent a key over the years.
She's an odd woman, Mrs. Quine, Anstice went on smoothly. Isn't she?
Haven't thought about it, lied Strike.
You know the neighbours heard her chasing him the night he disappeared?
I didn't know.
Yeah. She ran out of the house after him, screaming. The neighbours all say...
Anstice was watching Strike closely.
That she yelled, I know where you're off to, Owen.
Well, she thought she did know, Strike said with a shrug. She thought he was going to the writer's retreat Christian Fisher told him about, Bigley Hall.
She's refusing to move out of the house. She's got a mentally handicapped daughter who's never slept anywhere else.
Can you imagine Leonora overpowering Quine?
No, said Anstice, but we know it turned him on to be tied up, and I doubt they were married for 30-odd years without her knowing that.
You think they had a row, then she tracked him down and suggested a bit of bondage?
Anstice gave the suggestion of a small, token laugh, then said,
It doesn't look great for her, Bob. Angry wife with the key to the house, early access to the manuscript, plenty of motive if she knew about the mistress, especially if there was any question of Quine leaving her and the daughter for Kent.
Only her word for it that I know where you're going meant this writer's retreat and not the house on Talgarth Road.
Sounds convincing when you put it like that, Strike said.
But you don't think so.
She's my client, said Strike. I'm being paid to think of alternatives.
Has she told you where she used to work? Asked Anstice, with the air of a man about to play his trump card.
Back in Hay-on-Wye before they were married?
Go on, said Strike, not without a degree of apprehension.
In her uncle's butcher's shop, said Anstice.
Outside the study door, Strike heard Timothy Cormoran Anstice thudding down the stairs again, screaming his head off at some fresh disappointment. For the first time in their unsatisfactory acquaintance, Strike felt a real empathy for the boy.
Chapter 24 All well-bred persons lie. Besides, you are a woman. You must never speak what you think. William Congreve, Love for Love.
Strike's dreams that night, fueled by a day's consumption of Doom Bar, by talk of blood, acid and blowflies, were strange and ugly. Charlotte was getting married, and he, Strike, was running to an eerie Gothic cathedral, running on two whole functioning legs, because he knew that she had just given birth to his child, and he needed to see it, to save it. There she was, in the vast, dark, empty space, alone at the altar, struggling into a blood-red gown, and somewhere out of sight,
perhaps in a cold vestry, lay his baby, naked, helpless, and abandoned.
"Where is it?"
he asked.
"You're not seeing it. You didn't want it. Anyway, there's something wrong with it," she said.
He was afraid of what he would see if he went to find the baby. Her bridegroom was nowhere to be seen, but she was ready for the wedding, in a thick scarlet veil.
"Leave it. It's horrible," she said coldly, pushing past him, walking alone away from the altar, back up the aisle towards the distant doorway.
"You'd only touch it," she shouted over her shoulder. "I don't want you touching it. You'll see it eventually. It'll have to be announced," she added in a vanishing voice, as she became a sliver of scarlet dancing in the light of the open doors. "In the papers."
He was suddenly awake in the morning gloom, his mouth dry and his knee throbbing ominously in spite of a night's rest. Winter had slid in the night like a glacier over London. A hard frost had iced the outside of his attic window, and the temperature inside his rooms, with their ill-fitting windows and doors, and the total lack of insulation under the roof, had plummeted. Strike got up and reached for a sweater lying on the end of his bed. When he came to fix on his prosthesis, he found that his knee was exceptionally swollen after the journey to and from Greenwich. The shower water took longer than usual to heat up. He cranked up the thermostat, fearing burst pipes and frozen gutters, sub-zero living quarters, and an expensive plumber. After drying himself off, he unearthed his old sports bandages from the box on the landing to strap up his knee. He knew now, as clearly as though he had spent the night puzzling it out, how Helly Anstis knew Charlotte's wedding plans. He had been stupid not to think of it before. His subconscious had known. Once clean, dressed, and breakfasted, he headed downstairs. Glancing out of the window behind his desk, he noted that the knife-like cold was keeping away the cluster of journalists who had waited in vain for his return the previous day. Sleet pattered on the windows as he moved back to the outer office and Robin's computer. Here, in the search engine, he typed, "Charlotte Campbell on Jago Ross wedding." Pitiless and prompt came the results. Tatler, December 2010. Cover girl Charlotte Campbell on her wedding to the future Viscount of Croy.
"Tatler," said Strike aloud in the office.
He only knew of the magazine's existence because its society pages were full of Charlotte's friends. She had bought it sometimes to read ostentatiously in front of him, commenting on men she had once slept with or whose stately homes she had parted in. And now she was the Christmas cover girl. Even strapped up, his knee complained at having to support him down the metal stairs and out into the sleet. There was an early morning queue at the counter of the newsagents. Calmly he scanned the shelves of magazines, soap stars on the cheap ones and film stars on the expensive. December issues almost sold out, even though they were still in November. Emma Watson in white on the cover of Vogue, the superstar issue. Rihanna in pink on Marie Claire, the glamour issue. And on the cover of Tatler. Pale, perfect skin, black hair blown away from high cheekbones and wide hazel-green eyes, flecked like a russet apple. Two huge diamonds dangling from her ears, and a third on the hand lying lightly against her face. A dull, blunt hammer blow to the heart, absorbed without the slightest external sign. He took the magazine, the last on the shelf, paid for it, and returned to Denmark Street. It was 8:40. He shut himself in his office, sat down at his desk, and laid the magazine down in front of him.
"Incroyable! Former wild child turned future Viscountess, Charlotte Campbell."
The strapline ran across Charlotte's swan-like neck. It was the first time he had looked at her since she had clawed his face in this very office and run from him, straight into the arms of the Honourable Jago Ross. He supposed that they must airbrush all their pictures. Her skin could not be this flawless, the whites of her eyes this pure. But they had not exaggerated anything else, not the exquisite bone structure, nor, he was sure, the size of the diamond on her finger. Slowly, he turned to the contents page, and then to the article within. A double-page picture of Charlotte, very thin, in a glittering silver floor-length dress, standing in the middle of a long gallery lined with tapestries. Beside her, leaning on a card table and looking like a dissolute Arctic fox, was Jago Ross. More photographs over the page. Charlotte sitting on an ancient four-poster, laughing with her head thrown back, the white column of her neck rising from a sheer cream blouse. Charlotte and Jago in jeans and Wellington boots, walking hand in hand over parkland in front of their future home, with two Jack Russells at their heels. Charlotte windswept on the castle keep, looking over a shoulder draped in the Viscount's tartan. Doubtless, Helly Anstis had considered it £4.10 well spent. On the 4th of December this year, the 17th-century chapel at the Castle of Croy, never Croy Castle, it annoys the family, will be dusted off for its first wedding in over a century. Charlotte Campbell, breathtakingly beautiful daughter of 1960s It Girl Tula Claremont and academic and broadcaster Anthony Campbell, will marry the Honourable Jago Ross, heir to the castle and to his father's titles, principal of which is Viscount of Croy. The future Viscountess is a not altogether uncontroversial addition to the Rosses of Croy. But Jago laughs at the idea that anyone in his family could be less than delighted to welcome the former wild child into his old and rather grand Scottish family. "Actually, my mother always hoped we'd marry," he says. "We were boyfriend and girlfriend at Oxford, but I suppose we were just too young. Found each other again in London, both just out of relationships."
"Were you?" thought Strike. "Were you both just out of relationships? Or were you fucking her at the same time I was, so that she didn't know which of us had fathered the baby she was worried she might be carrying? Changing the dates to cover every eventuality, keeping her options open.
Made headlines in her youth when she went missing from Beedale's for 7 days, causing a national search. Admitted to rehab at the age of 25. "Old news, move on, nothing to see," says Charlotte brightly. "Look, I had a lot of fun in my youth, but it's time to settle down, and honestly, I can't wait."
"Fun, was it?" Strike asked her stunning picture.
"Fun, standing on that roof and threatening to jump. Fun, calling me from that psychiatric hospital and begging me to get you out." Ross, fresh from a very messy divorce that has kept the gossip columns busy. "I wish we could have settled it without the lawyers," he sighs.
"I can't wait to be a stepmummy," trills Charlotte. "If I have to spend one more evening with the Anstis's bratty kids, Corm, I swear to God I'll brain one of them." And, in Lucy's suburban back garden, watching Strike's nephews playing football, "Why are these children such shit?"
The expression on Lucy's round face when she overheard it. His own name leaping off the page. Including a surprising fling with Johnny Rokeby's eldest son, Cormoran Strike, who made headlines last year.
A surprising fling with Johnny Rokeby's eldest son. Johnny Rokeby's eldest.
He closed the magazine with a sudden reflexive movement and slid it into his bin. 16 years, on and off. 16 years of the torture, the madness and occasional ecstasy. And then, after all those times she had left him, throwing herself into the arms of other men as other women cast themselves onto railway tracks, he had walked out. In doing so, he had crossed an unforgivable Rubicon, for it had always been understood that he should stand rock-like, to be left and returned to, never flinching, never giving up. But on that night when he had confronted her with the tangle of lies she had told about the baby in her belly, and she had become hysterical and furious, The mountain had moved at last, out of the door, with an ashtray flung after it. His black eye had barely healed when she had announced her engagement to Ross. 3 weeks it had taken her, because she knew only one way to respond to pain, to wound the transgressor as deeply as possible, with no thought of the consequences to herself. And he knew in his bones, no matter how arrogant his friends might tell him he was being, that the Tatler pictures, the dismissal of their relationship in the terms that would hurt him most. He could hear her spelling it out for the society mag. He's Johnny Ropeby's son. The castle of fucking Croy, all of it, was done with a view to hurting him, wanting him to watch and to see, to regret and to pity. She had known what Ross was. She had told Strike about the poorly disguised alcoholism and violence, passed through the blue-blooded network of gossip that had kept her informed through the years. She had laughed about her lucky escape. Laughed. Self-immolation in a ball gown. Watch me burn, Bluey. The wedding was in 10 days' time, and if he had ever been sure of anything in his life, it was that if he called Charlotte right now and said, run away with me, even after their filthy scenes, the hateful things she had called him, the lies and the mess, and the several tons of baggage under which their relationship had finally splintered, she would say yes. Running away was her life's blood, and he had been her favourite destination, freedom and safety combined. She had said it to him over and over again after fights that would have killed them both if emotional wounds could bleed. I need you. You're my everything, you know that. You're the only place I've ever felt safe, Bluey. He heard the glass door on the landing open and close, the familiar sounds of Robin arriving at work, removing her coat, filling the kettle. Work had always been his salvation. Charlotte had hated the way he could switch from crazy violent scenes, from her tears and her pleas and her threats, to immerse himself totally in a case. She had never managed to stop him putting on his uniform, never prevented his return to work, never succeeded in forcing him away from an investigation. She deplored his focus, his allegiance to the army, his ability to shut her out, seeing it as a betrayal, as abandonment. Now, on this cold winter's morning, sitting in his office with her picture in the bin beside him, Strike found himself craving orders, a case abroad, an enforced sojourn on another continent. He did not want to trail after unfaithful husbands and girlfriends, or insert himself into the petty disputes of shoddy businessmen. Only one subject had ever matched Charlotte for the fascination it exercised over him. Unnatural death.
Morning, he said, limping into the outer office, where Robin was making 2 mugs of tea. We'll have to be quick with these. We're going out.
Where? Asked Robin in surprise. The sleet was sliding wetly down their windows. She could still feel how it had burned her face as she hurried over the slippery pavements, desperate to get inside.
Got stuff to do on the Quine case.
It was a lie. The police had all the power. What could he do that they were not doing better? And yet he knew in his gut that Anstis lacked the nose for the strange and the warped that would be needed to find this killer.
You've got Caroline Ingalls at 10.
Shit, well, I'll put her off. Thing is, forensics reckon Quine died very soon after he disappeared.
He took a mouthful of hot, strong tea. He seemed more purposeful, more energized than she had seen him for a while.
That puts the spotlight right back on the people who had early access to the manuscript. I want to find out where they all live, and whether they live alone. Then we're going to recce their houses. Find out how hard it would have been to get in and out carrying a bag of guts. Whether they might have places they could bury or burn evidence.
It was not much, but it was all he could do today, and he was desperate to do something.
You're coming, he added. You're always good at this stuff.
What, being your Watson? she said, apparently indifferent. The anger she had carried with her out of the Cambridge the previous day had not quite burned out. We could find out about their houses online. Look at them on Google Earth.
Yeah, good thinking, rejoined Strike. Why case locations when you could just look at out-of-date photos?
Stung, she said, I'd be more than happy.
Good. I'll cancel Ingalls. You get online and find out addresses for Christian Fisher, Elizabeth Tassel, Daniel Chard, Jerry Waldegrave, and Michael Fancourt.
We'll nip along to Clem Attlee Court and have another look from the point of view of hiding evidence. From what I saw in the dark, there were a lot of bins and bushes. Oh, and call the Bridlington Bookshop in Putney. We can have a word with the old bloke who claims he met Quine there on the 8th.
He strode back into his office, and Robin sat down at her computer. The scarf she had just hung up was dripping icily onto the floor, but she did not care. The memory of Quine's mutilated body continued to haunt her, yet she was possessed of an urge, concealed from Matthew like a dirty secret, to find out more, to find out everything. What infuriated her was that Strike, who of all people should have understood, could not see in her what so obviously burned in him.